Are you searching for the best in online black radio? Then go to blacktalkradionetwork.com, helping you filter through the noise. Real talk, black talk.
The internet is full of half-truths and all-out lies. We've all seen them, and many people on social media complaining about it. Here's your chance to show and prove. WorldAfropedia.com is a black-owned and operated encyclopedia. There are several thousand articles, but we need help. We can't uncover all the truth ourselves. So please, join us and become a writer, editor, or blogger for WorldAfropedia.com today. Every little bit counts. We owe it to the future generations to put the truth out there. Visit WorldAfropedia.com, the African-centered encyclopedia, a global database of African knowledge for the purpose of bringing about global African wisdom and understanding. WorldAfropedia.com.
The gay rights movement is changing everything.
When patrons of a New York City gay bar, the Stonewall Inn, battled with police on a June night in 1969, few could have envisioned the movement that battle sparked for acceptance and equality for LGBTQ people. As part of our coverage of this week's 50th anniversary, John Yang spoke to two women from different generations about what the movement has achieved and their visions for the future.
For Carla Jay and her wife, Karen Kerner, even running errands in their Upper West Side neighborhood brings reminders of this month's milestone Pride celebration.
Oh, look, Pride. Oh, that's hilarious.
Jay, a retired college professor, is among the pioneers of the LGBTQ rights movement. The first female chair of the Gay Liberation Front, one of the earliest activist groups to emerge from Stonewall. College student Maya Padilla, who's bisexual, is getting ready for Pride weekend, too. She's an intern at the Brooklyn Community Pride Center, what she hopes is the first step in a career of community organizing. Jay and Padilla are two links in the long chain of LGBTQ rights activists. We introduced them to each other at New York's Lesbian, Gay, Bisexual, and Transgender Community Center.
It's just so many.
Their stories provide a glimpse of how attitudes toward the LGBTQ community and protections for their rights have changed over the last half century and how they haven't. Jay was raised in Brooklyn.
I grew up in the early 1950s, and we didn't have any vocabulary for being a lesbian or a gay man or trans. I just knew that I wasn't like my mother. I wasn't like my mother's friends. I had no words for being different.
I grew up in Staten Island for a majority of my very young life. I knew one lesbian couple, and even then, the way that they were spoken about and the way that their family was spoken about was different.
For both, college was a turning point in very different ways.
When I went upstate for school, I really found myself in an area, in a situation where I was removed from the private eyes of my family, of my friends, and free to be whoever I wanted to be. And it was the first time that I felt removed enough from my reality to play out this part of who I am.
The first week of college at Barnard, I heard that two girls in their dorm room who were making out were seen by a guy across the street at Columbia with a binocular, and they were expelled. And that encouraged me to hide in the closet very deeply for a number of years.
She only came out to her parents in her late 20s when she was about to appear on a nationally televised talk show to discuss gay rights. She wanted to tell her father first.
I said, look, my being a lesbian is like my being left-handed. And I discovered that he wasn't happy that I was left-handed.
They planned to keep her mother in the dark and away from the television. It didn't work.
My aunt called her up in the middle of the night and said, your daughter's on television, and she's a queer, she said. She called my father into the bedroom, and she said to my father, Carla's on TV, and she says she's a lesbian. What is it?
What was your relationship like with your parents from there on?
My mother grew to tolerate if I came to visit them with a partner, but my father never accepted it. And then he finally decided I was not his biological child. And he erased me from his life.
I can imagine how painful that was.
Yeah.
Maya, what was your experience like?
So I had a different experience. I came out to my parents in my junior year of college. They were understanding, although there was a little bit of like a knowledge gap. What does it mean to be bisexual?
So is it harder because you're telling them you're bisexual rather than telling them you're a lesbian?
Oh, 100%. We're spoken as if we don't exist in the community at all, as if we're playing a game, choosing the ability to be queer and choosing to be straight when it's beneficial. But my years in the closet were just as painful.
And then it's down this way?
Yeah.
From the center, we set out through the streets of Greenwich Village for an address Jay remembers well.
It wasn't that far in. Here's the address. It's like 149 or something.
It's now a restaurant. But from 1965 until 1973, it was home to Cookies, at the time one of New York's few lesbian bars.
It was so oppressive in here for us.
She recalls bartenders coercing patrons to buy more drinks and strictly rationing toilet paper for the bathroom. Only two sheets per customer.
Just for being a lesbian.
So even though you were treated horribly,
yes,
it was still a safe haven?
It was the only place we had. We put up with everything gratefully. We were happy to go in and see women who looked like us.
And how do your experiences in lesbian bars compared to what Carly described in Cookies?
A lot more positive. A lot more positive.
These days, Padilla has more and more pleasant and nurturing options, like the Brooklyn Community Pride Center, where she's an intern.
This center has given me a lot of different opportunities to grow just as a person. It's really given me a place to really integrate all of, I think, the skills that I have and all of the experiences that I've had, and added that last component of queerness into it.
It's a long way from 1969 in Stonewall. The morning after the uprising, Jay headed to the bar. One of the first things she saw was a message in the window.
It was a big sign with white letters telling people to keep the peace, to cooperate with the police, and to go home and to be peaceful. And I was shocked because it seemed to me that this was not the time to be peaceful. There was a lot of anger, and people were just talking and shouting and saying, what do we do? What do we do? This is enough. We have to stop it. Enough already.
When you think about what was launched here that night in the past 50 years, what do you think?
I think it's really amazing what has happened. I mean, it's just incredible. That was a sea change in how we thought about ourselves and how we were going to take our rights. If they gave them to us or not, we were here to take them.
Carla, how old were you in 1969?
I was 22 years old.
Maya, how old are you?
I'm 22.
What's your hope or what's your vision for the next 50 years?
I hope that we're sustaining what we have, right, first and foremost, but we're expanding into other movements and making our voices heard on those boards, in those marches, on those committees. Because if our voice isn't there with other social movements, then we're not really going to create a society that's truly integrated.
When we lit our torches in the embers of the Stonewall Uprising, we had no idea where we would go. To see someone like Maya, who's got a torch burning brightly, I still have my torch, I'm limping along, but to see young people like her, my hope is so bright and wonderful now.
Do you see a little bit of yourself?
Yes, it's great, you know, and she will define her own issues, and she's going to see that in 50 years, people will think that discrimination against LGBT people was a science fiction movie.
Two women born 50 years apart, marking a movement's milestone anniversary and heading into the next 50 years. For the PBS NewsHour, I'm John Yang in New York.
I sip way too much drink. I don't think I can think. I won't try to tell lies. This blunt got me too high.
This sober curious movement is relatively new, and scientists are just beginning to study the health effects of taking a short break from alcohol. Here's NPR's Allison Aubrey with what researchers have learned so far.
Whether it's sober September or dry July, pick your month, there's a handful of small studies that have evaluated what happens when people stop drinking for 30 days. Aaron White is a senior scientific advisor at the National Institute on Alcohol Abuse and Alcoholism. He's reviewed all the studies, and he points first to one published last year. Researchers in Britain compared a group of men and women who drank moderately with a group who agreed to 1 month of abstinence. Their average age was mid-40s.
And they found that at the end of that month, just after 1 month, people by and large lost some weight. They had improvements in insulin sensitivity. Their blood pressure numbers improved. Their livers looked a little healthier.
The improvements were small, but White says he didn't expect so many changes.
The findings of these studies are actually very surprising.
When it comes to changes in the liver, as part of a separate study, researchers in the Netherlands took liver measurements on a small group of people who drank, on average, about 2 drinks a day. But after a 1 month break, the researchers found a measurable reduction of a compound called GGT, which is a marker of oxidative stress.
So everybody is aware that you can do some serious damage to your liver with chronic high levels of alcohol consumption. But one of the things we're learning is that even moderate levels of drinking can tax the liver.
There's also evidence that a break from alcohol can improve sleep and energy levels. And White says, at the very least, a break can help people sort of reevaluate their relationship with alcohol.
I think sometimes we're not aware of how our habits are actually affecting our lives until we take a break from them. And in the case of alcohol, I think that what seems to be happening is people take a break and they're pleasantly surprised to find that they feel better.
We should point out that this does not happen for everyone. In one study of about 850 British men and women, a 30-day break from alcohol worked for some, but
the heavier drinkers often drop out. They don't make it through the month of abstinence.
But for those who did make it through, there seemed to be a lasting impact on their drinking habits.
6 months later, long after that period of abstinence ended, about half of the people still said they were drinking less.
So for people who want to take a break, there's a lot of preliminary evidence that it can be beneficial. Allison Aubrey, NPR News.
Cool, refreshing drink.
We have an update now on a story that we've been following for more than 3 years. In February of 2016, I went to Flint, Michigan, where I visited Janaea McDonald and her family at home. Like the rest of Flint, she was using bottled water to bathe, drink, and cook.
I started my chicken off this morning with about 8 bottles of water to start to thaw it out.
Improperly treated water had corroded the city's pipes. That leached lead into the water that came out of the tap. Janaea and her husband have 2 sons, Justice and Josiah. When I first met them, they were 6 and 2, and she had taught them not to turn on the faucet.
What I tell you about that water is poison.
As the years went by, the state of Michigan insisted the water was safe and stopped distributing bottled water. People in Flint, including the mayor, didn't believe it. When I went back last October, Justice was 9 years old and hadn't had a drink from the tap in years.
Why does the pipes break in Flint and in the others, they don't?
Janaea gave him a level-headed answer and then privately broke down when we were alone.
How do I think a government that's predominantly white, how do they show me what they feel about me and us here in Flint? They showed us.
This week, she sent me a message with some news, so we've called up Janaea again. Welcome back to All Things Considered.
Thank you.
So, what is the news?
Well, I was very excited. I woke up one morning and saw all of these trucks in front of my house and a digger. I thought we were finally going to get our pipes replaced, but that was not the case.
Explain.
They discovered that the pipes that were in the front of our house leading to the street were copper, and they looked at our pipes in the house and they discovered those too were copper, and they went back outside and proceeded to cover the hole back up and said we won't be doing any replacement here.
You had been waiting for years for this visit, and the visit happened, and now?
Now nothing. I just got my pretty yard destroyed, basically.
Does it give you any reassurance to know that your pipes are copper and not lead?
No, none whatsoever.
Why not?
I just feel like the right thing to do is to replace everybody's pipes regardless, at least for nothing else but a peace of mind.
Is there any test that could be done on your water, any reassurance you could get from an expert that would restore your faith in this system?
I doubt it. I doubt it. It's so much damage has been done. I don't trust it. Even when I went out of town for spring break, I found myself using bottled water to brush my teeth. It's such a habit now. It's part of my life now, so I don't think it's going to change.
How many people in Flint do you think feel this way? When you talk to neighbors and friends, is that pretty common?
Yes, yes.
I can imagine people listening to this and saying, look, I understand the trust has been damaged, but if they tell you that the pipes are copper and you test the water and it comes out clean, what more can they do?
You're right. I guess there's nothing more they can do, but trust is a hard thing to gain back. So for my own protecting my family, I choose to use bottled water.
The first time I talked to you, you said you wanted to stay in Flint and make the city better. And then over the years, you thought maybe it would be difficult to sell the house and there were reasons it would be tough to move away. How are you feeling about that now?
Flint is home. It's hard to say that I want to move. My family is here. My friends are here. My children, this is home for them. So for me, I would love to make change in this city. You know, I can see where our city is banding together and we are trying to just fight against the odds.
Janae McDonald, thank you for speaking with us once again.
Thank you, Ari.
Yeah, that was the summertime, but you know what comes with the summertime. Beef.
Most people eating fast food used to ask,
where's the beef? Hey, where's the beef?
Now burger eaters are asking, where's the plant-based meat alternative?
Ah! What in the devil's name is this?
That may sound like a mouthful, but fast food chains like Burger King and Del Taco are going whole hog on vegan patties. Is fake meat the food of the future? We asked you.
Hi, this is John Wood from Detroit. Yeah, I've tried fake meat. I prefer just to eat vegetables, fried or cooked or raw.
My name is Lazaro Fernandez and I'm from Miami, Florida. I'm not a vegan or vegetarian, but whenever I see the Impossible Burger on a menu, I have to give it a try.
Tina Frankie, I'm calling from St. Louis, Missouri.
Mary from Safety Harbor, Florida.
I've been a vegetarian for over 15 years.
I'm a vegetarian.
And I've tried the Impossible Burger.
I have tried fake meat, the Impossible Burger.
And I love it.
I do not like it.
The fake food has too many ingredients for me. It always ends up tasting like a Dorito. Burger.
I gave up meat for a reason, because I don't want to eat meat.
I think it's a great alternative for red meat, and slowly but surely going to make its way into every city in America.
I also think it's going to eventually be an option, possibly to be considered to offset the environmental impact of large-scale factory farming.
Hungry yet? Well, let's talk about it. I'm Tanzina Vega, and this is The Takeaway. Right now, the fake meat market is dominated by two companies, Impossible Foods and Beyond Meat. Each has its own secret sauce when it comes to creating burgers that are as meat-like as possible. Customers and investors are going ham over these new vegan options, and they're advertised as healthier and more environmentally friendly than beef, and they're seen by many as a cheaper way to cut back on meat in our diets. But the vegan feeding frenzy has some people questioning whether these animal-free burgers are really the solution to our public health crisis and climate change, or if this market is just a big plant-based bubble. Heather Haddon is a reporter for The Wall Street Journal covering food and restaurants, and Monica Burton is associate restaurant editor at Eater. Heather, Monica, thanks for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks for having me.
All right. We got through all those food puns and we appreciate it. Monica, let's get some of the basics out of the way here. What exactly are these meat alternatives made out of? What makes them taste and feel like meat?
Yeah. So Impossible Foods and Beyond Burger have different formulas for their products. Impossible is a patty, but also a meat product that's primarily made out of soy protein. There's also some sunflower oil, some potato protein in there. But most importantly, what Impossible has is the heme molecule, which is found in real meat, and it's what makes meat taste like meat. And so Impossible Foods found a way to derive this molecule from yeast, and they put it in their burger, and it's what makes the burger bleed, and it's what gives it that Maillard reaction and makes it meat-like. Beyond, on the other hand, is made up of pea proteins, mung bean protein, rice proteins, canola oil, there's some potato starch, and it has some beet juice extract that gives it a pink color that makes it look like meat, but it does not have the heme.
So Heather, who is the target audience for these products? Is it meat eaters who are trying to stop eating meat but still like the experience of meat, or is it vegetarians? Like, who are they marketing this to?
So these companies say that they are really looking to cater to folks who eat meat. Impossible Foods is something that 96% of those who consume their products actually eat meat. So their goal is to try to sway people who love actual beef that these are real alternatives, that they taste similar enough that they are a worthwhile alternative for folks who want to cut down on meat.
And Heather, how does the price compare to beef?
So yeah, currently they are more expensive. So on average, current figures show that a meat burger costs about $3.50 in quick service, while these burgers cost about $5. If you get them in a finer dining restaurant, which is where these alternatives really started, the markup can be something like $4. So they currently are much more expensive. These companies say the prices will fall, but they are at a premium currently.
Monica, the big question is, I think, for a lot of folks is, are these alternatives actually healthier than traditional meat? I mean, are there any health drawbacks to these, given the list of ingredients that you just read us?
The companies that produce these burgers say that they are healthier. They're lower in cholesterol. I think that the one question that remains is the effects of genetically modified foods and processed foods. I think we know that whole foods are in general better, but when compared to a fast food burger, the Impossible Burger and the Beyond Burger are better for you.
Compared to just like your traditional,
mm-hmm. beef burger.
And the big question, Monica, is also a lot of folks are thinking, well, if I start eating these plant-based alternatives, this will help save the environment. Is that true?
The studies that the companies themselves have conducted show that it is true. Impossible says that one Impossible Burger uses 96% less land, 87% less water, and 89% fewer emissions. And for Beyond all of those metrics, it's around 90% or higher. So yes, they are better for the environment, and this is the mission that Impossible and Beyond are using to market their products.
Heather, let's talk a little bit about Impossible Foods and Beyond as companies here. How were they able to sort of really take hold of this market and rise to become the top two players here?
So a lot and lots of money. So investors have poured millions of dollars into both of these companies with the intention that and hope that they would really take off and generate more mass market appeal than traditional veggie burgers. And so far that has been the case. So Beyond Meat, it had its IPO last month, and its stock price has gone from initial $25 a share. Last time I looked yesterday, it was at $140. So obviously that has done very well. Impossible still has not had an IPO, but has just raised hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars. And they really need that money now, though. So one of the problems with these companies is there's so much demand that they have not been able to scale up quick enough to meet it. So there's been a lot of issues with supply, with shortages. They say that they are investing in their facilities, using that money right now to scale up. And then just one thing on the health aspect, these products do have a lot of sodium. They have a lot of fat. So they do not have meat, but some vegetarians really question whether they are healthier than just having a veggie burger or some kind of vegetable alternative.
Hmm. And also, we're seeing a lot of, we mentioned at the top that fast food chains are really starting to try to get a foothold into this market. Heather, I'm wondering if you could tell us a little bit about the strategy there from the fast food restaurant industry. Are they looking at this as a way to not lose consumers who are concerned about perhaps changing their diet, or is this a way to offer new alternatives to current consumers?
Yeah, it's really been quite sudden and remarkable when a big chain like Burger King tests this kind of product and finds it so successful that they decide to roll it out nationwide. You mentioned Del Taco. There's lots of other chains looking at this. White Castle was one of the first to use it. I mean, these are brands you wouldn't normally associate with a vegetarian alternative. But for these companies, they see this as a way to stay relevant. When I was talking to the White Castle executives, they say, you know, we want future generations to still eat our burgers, not just folks who maybe grew up with them and are nostalgic for them, but no longer will eat them in 10 years. But what we really have to see is this going to sustain? So some initial figures show that there was a huge surge of interest when Burger King first rolled this out in test markets in St. Louis. But the question is, will that remain? Will folks still continue to come and have these when some of the buzz has died down? We'll have to see.
And Monica, I'm wondering from the restaurateur side of things and for the people who are actually making these burgers, what do they think about the meat alternative? Are they excited about it? Is it enjoyable to cook with these products?
There are a lot of chefs that are very excited about it. And Impossible in particular was very savvy in the way it rolled out its burger, in that it enlisted really big name chefs like David Chang and Tracy Desjardins and Michael Simon. And they, before giving it to grocery stores, before putting it in fast food restaurants, they gave it to chefs who used the product and said, I like this product. This is a good thing. And it basically trickled down from there.
Heather, do we know whether or not the average consumer is willing or interested in paying a premium for this type of food? So I'm wondering for mid to lower income Americans, are consumers interested in paying a premium for this?
So studies show that people are definitely interested in eating less meat. There's definitely a trend there where people are trying to reduce their beef and other kind of meat aspects of their diet. The question is, will they really follow through with that? It's one thing to tell someone conducting a survey they want to eat less meat, another thing to actually go to a chain restaurant and pay more for it. Now, currently, the chains are offering these products for a little bit more than an actual beef burger, so the hit isn't too bad. There's a lot of questions whether they're actually making money off this. It seems that they are absorbing some of the cost for now just to keep getting people in their doors and try these products. But I think long term, we probably won't see a huge influx of, you know, budget consumers trying these products, but they are, like I said, really proving to be a novelty right now and creating buzz for, you know, foodies and people who are sort of interested in avoiding meat.
You just mentioned whether or not this is going to move forward. I was going to ask both of you that question. I'm wondering, Monica, are we going to see plant-based pork chops or steaks or other forms of meat? We know that plant-based chicken alternatives are out there now. What do you see?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, there are companies working on fish as well.
Fish?
Yes.
Wow, okay.
So I think we're going to continue to see people in this space innovating, because I think the market for these companies right now isn't vegetarians. It's people who eat meat and are maybe interested in reducing their environmental impact or being a little bit healthier. But they're not looking to go after the vegetarians. It's the meat eaters that they are trying to market to and get to make a lifestyle change and hopefully have a huge environmental impact.
Heather, we forgot to ask about one big player in all this, the meat industry. How are they reacting to this? Are they seeing, you know, we've got to now start doing less meat and more plant-based alternatives? What's the industry saying?
So the meat industry, the actual cattlemen who produce the beef, clearly are not happy with this. They are particularly upset about the labeling concerns, calling these alternatives meat when they say technically they really aren't meat and they want the FDA to enforce existing rules around this. But the actual meat companies like Tyson and some of the other meat giants themselves are actually investing in their own alternatives. They see this is something that they need to get into as well to compete for the long term. One other thing I think we should just briefly mention is the actual veggie burger companies. They are also trying to compete in this, including chicken, fish products, like you mentioned. So they don't want to lose market share either.
Well, we've been talking fake meat with Heather Haddon, reporter for The Wall Street Journal, covering food, retail, and policy, and Monica Burton, associate restaurant editor at Eater. Heather and Monica, thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks so much.
I'm in love with Mary Jane.
A woman who has spent her life being mocked and teased for an unusual name has now used that experience to earn a PhD. Marijuana Pepsi Van Dyke has become Dr. Marijuana Pepsi Van Dyke. The title of her dissertation, Black Names in White Classrooms, Teacher Behaviors and Student Perceptions. Dr. Van Dyke sees her name as something to be proud of and not just an obstacle to overcome. Marijuana Pepsi Van Dyke, welcome to All Things Considered.
Thank you for having me.
Now, you have two sisters named Kimberly and Robin. So how did you end up with this more unusual name?
That is a great question, one I've asked several times. My mom just shared that she felt a kinship with me and she felt like this name would take me around the world.
Have you always been proud of your name, or was that a journey for you?
It was a journey. When I was very young, up till about 9 years of age, marijuana was just a beautiful name. I received, you know, accolades. Oh, your name is so pretty. But then I moved to a new city and all of a sudden I was made very aware that Marijuana Pepsi was actually very unusual. And so I just had to accept it and go forth with it.
I understand teachers insisted on calling you Mary, even though that wasn't the nickname you preferred.
I wouldn't say that they insisted. I have had some amazing teachers and educators over the years, and I think they wanted to make me feel more comfortable. They could see what was happening and see what the other children were doing, and they were trying to smooth the way and make things easier for me.
Do you think it shaped your character dealing with that kind of pushback?
Oh, most definitely. Growing up with a name like that, I'm an introvert and I don't like a great deal of attention. I was lonely, isolated. I just wanted to be anywhere, but somewhere meeting someone new and hearing all the questions.
When you were a student, did both black and white teachers react strongly to your name, or was it only white teachers?
At the time, it was only white teachers. And I believe it's because in the black community, we're used to having names that are more cultural. I'll put it this way. One of my research participants said it. White people like things standardized, and that includes names. We are all human. We all hear things that make us look twice. But it's what you do after you recognize that you have this feeling about it, and it's what you act on from that point on. That's the most important part.
So what's your advice to a teacher who might be listening for when they have a kid in their class who has an unusual name, and that teacher might have an implicit negative reaction?
Well, my advice is simply acceptance. I don't want to come off as saying that teachers are doing something wrong. I understand the name marijuana is unusual. It's not every day you get that. And then you have a student in class called Marijuana Pepsi or maybe Drushika. And if you're curious about it, feel free to ask. Perhaps not in front of the other 25 students. Don't ask who named them in a condescending manner and say, I never would have named my child that. What kind of parents do you have? It's those types of things.
Well, Dr. Van Dyke, thank you for speaking with us today and congratulations on your PhD.
I really appreciate it. Thank you so much.
That's Dr. Marijuana Pepsi Van Dyke, who just earned her PhD in Leadership for the Advancement of Learning and Service in Higher Education from Wisconsin's Cardinal Stritch University.
New York, New York.
We're going to look now at the problems some communities face after a natural disaster. An NPR investigation earlier this year found that money from a federal program that helps people move after disaster strikes goes disproportionately to whiter communities. Charles Lane of member station WSHU visited one Long Island community where flooding destroyed many homes and black residents were struggling to get government aid.
Horton Avenue in Riverhead, Long Island, isn't the ideal place to build a home.
I grew up, I'll show you where.
It's at the bottom of a long hill. There's a marsh on one side of the road and a duck pond on the other.
Right in there.
But that's where a dozen African-American families from Virginia settled back in the 1920s. Hobson's house was built from an old barn.
My mom bought the land for a little under $1,000, and she bought the wood for $500.
Hobson says in those days, Horton Avenue was one of the few places in Riverhead acceptable for black people to live. And like many disadvantaged communities, it was low-lying and prone to repeated flooding.
As the rain just keeps on coming.
The month of March has been brutal for most of the Northeast.
March records in parts of New York, Massachusetts, New Jersey, and Maine.
So a lot of cleanup to be done.
March of 2010 was a month of storms, capped with 3 days of straight rain. The neighborhood of Horton Avenue turned into a lake with a dozen tiny homes sticking out.
I remember opening my back door and all the water just rushing out of the door onto my feet.
Desperate, they went through the list of federal disaster aid programs. The only one they were eligible for was a hazard mitigation grant, where the government would buy their homes and demolish them. It was their only hope, but it would be a bureaucratic morass. So she called Shirley Carverdale for help.
It was months of hammering and trying to get the attention of the media.
Coverdale is an influential community activist based out of Riverhead's First Baptist Church. To help Horton Avenue, she spent 3 months advocating for an extension to the Presidential Disaster Declaration.
We called in every elected official that we could find and people in FEMA and county agencies.
During that fight, Coverdale pointed out that properties in Rhode Island and a beach in the Hamptons were already on the project list.
But here was an area that was a decidedly different area. It was a poor neighborhood, and it was slipping through the cracks.
Coverdale faulted politicians and journalists from Long Island all the way to Washington for bias, overlooking Horton Avenue.
Until we called it out as racism, and that was the underpinning of it.
An NPR investigation this year found that most government buyouts of disaster-prone properties have happened in neighborhoods that are predominantly white. But FEMA adamantly denies any bias at all in how grants get distributed. In this case, the agency points to the state, which asks for the money. Ann Bink is Deputy Commissioner for Storm Recovery in New York.
Every community has the equal opportunity to apply for grants through the Hazard Mitigation Program when funds are released by FEMA.
She, in turn, points to local towns and counties which pick the projects.
We're not targeting any community. We're targeting the best projects that mitigate risk in the future.
After all that, getting the Federal Disaster Declaration was just the first step. Then it fell back to Hobson to work with her town to do all the paperwork and actually apply for the grant. It took a year and a half and multiple rejections. She says her neighbors couldn't handle this much bureaucracy.
People weren't speaking up. I was really speaking up for them. I would go and I would meet with them. They would tell me their desires, their wants and needs, and then I would advocate on their behalf.
In the end, the government did buy and demolish homes on Horton Avenue. Hobson and her neighbors were able to move, but
if I had to do it all over again, Linda Hobson Heath would not. But if God forced me to, then I would. I'm glad it's over, and I don't ever want to go through anything like that again.
At that time, in 2010, New York didn't have a mechanism to help disadvantaged communities. But it has since revamped its website to allow towns and counties, if they want, to highlight them. As for national solutions, FEMA says it's largely up to Congress. Since the NPR investigation, the Government Accountability Office has accepted a congressional request to look into whether disaster relief makes inequality worse. For NPR News, I'm Charles Lane on Long Island in New York.
Medical apartheid. The dark history of medical experimentation on black Americans from colonial times to the present.
When patients don't pay their hospital bills, some hospitals respond with lawsuits. A study published today in the Journal of the American Medical Association finds about a third of hospitals in Virginia take that route.
One of them, Mary Washington Hospital in Fredericksburg, files so many lawsuits against patients that the second Friday of every month is reserved for them at the local courthouse. And this month, 300 cases were on the docket.
Mary Washington and other hospitals around the country defend the practice as a legitimate way to collect on unpaid bills. Patient advocates say it's immoral and can ruin patients' lives. NPR's Selena Simmons-Duffin reports.
The Fredericksburg General District Court is a red brick courthouse with Greek columns in a quaint colonial town. An actual horse and carriage is usually parked outside the visitor center down the street. On this sunny morning, the second Friday in June, the first defendant at court is a young woman with glasses and a plaid purple shirt.
My name is Deja Smith. I am 24 years old.
She arrived early, having just worked an overnight shift.
I work with older people, so I take care of them. I feed them. I bathe them. I do everything for them.
Inside the courthouse, it's not hard to figure out where to go. The hospital sues so many patients, it's got a system down. Right through court security, there are signs on colored paper. Mary Washington cases this way. The elevator doors open, another Mary Washington sign. Mary Washington billing staff walk through the halls and set up a kind of field office in a witness room right at the back of the courtroom. On this day in June, only a handful of the 300 people summoned to court show up. Deja Smith is the first called to the bench.
So when I went in there today, that's why the lawyer came up there.
Back in 2017, Smith was admitted to Mary Washington Hospital for 2 weeks. She doesn't want to give the details.
I was not myself, so I walked myself into Mary Washington to get help, to get myself on track.
Smith says she never saw a bill and no one talked to her or called to explain the hospital's financial assistance policy. At the time, she was working part-time at Walmart for $11 an hour. She had no insurance. According to Mary Washington Healthcare's financial assistance policy, someone making less than $25,000 without health insurance should qualify for free care. But Smith was sued for over $12,000. Last year, the hospital began taking money out of her paycheck.
When I looked at my pay stub, I'm like, well, I only have $600-some in my account. But it says garnish, and I'm like, who's garnishing my check? So I called my company and asked them, and they said it's Mary Washington. Mary Washington never called me and told me it was garnishing my check. I didn't get nothing from them. They just taken out of my account.
Smith knows Mary Washington Hospital sues a lot. She says one of her relatives is on a payment plan. Her coworker was sued over an unpaid bill, too, from Mary Washington Hospital.
And that's crazy. Like, people need help. Y'all just money hungry.
There are no good national data, but reporters have identified hospitals suing thousands of patients all over the country, in North Carolina, Ohio, Nebraska. In 2014, NPR and ProPublica published stories about a hospital suing patients in Missouri. Many of the hospitals that do this are nonprofits.
Under federal law, nonprofit hospitals that have tax-exempt status need to follow certain IRS rules and regulations.
That's Jennifer Bosco of the National Consumer Law Center.
And there was a rule put in place as part of the Affordable Care Act that requires nonprofit hospitals to have financial assistance policies and also limit certain harsher debt collection practices for lower-income people.
Mary Washington Healthcare stands by its practice of suing patients. It says the practice is legal and that lawsuits are a last resort. Lisa Henry is Director of Communications for the health system.
We have a process that we are going to try to reach our patients by phone, by mail, by email, any access point we're given from them when they register.
She says they try to reach patients for around 7 months.
Unfortunately, if we don't hear back from folks or they don't make a payment, we're assuming that they're not prepared to pay their bill. So we do issue papers to the court.
Even though thousands of cases a year may seem like a lot, Henry says it's actually a small percentage of their patients.
The vast majority of our patients fill out the paperwork or call us. A small percentage then goes on to collection, and then even smaller goes to litigation. We see thousands of patients a year, and less than 1% go to litigation.
Henry says Mary Washington is getting unfairly singled out for an issue all hospitals are grappling with, how to collect on their unpaid bills. She says other hospitals use private debt collection agencies. Mary Washington chose the legal system instead, in part because it's more transparent.
We selected to do this because we think it is a fair and appropriate way to help our patients reach out to us.
Without national data, it's hard to know how many nonprofit hospitals sue patients who haven't paid their bills versus using debt collectors versus writing it off, says Erin Fusey-Brown. She's a law professor at Georgia State University.
I haven't seen data estimating the number of hospitals that are taking these actions and how common or frequent this is.
Whether it's common or not, she says, there are bigger philosophical questions here about a hospital's role.
There has to be a balance between getting their bills paid, but also being a reasonable community member.
Garnishment generally doesn't bring in very much for hospitals filing lawsuits. In the JAMA study of Virginia hospitals, the average of total revenue from garnishment was 0.1%. For Mary Washington, last year, garnishing accounted for 0.2% of their total revenue, which was $624 million.
It doesn't seem to be worth the effort. And it's so ruinous to the patient, not just the financial obligation, but the effect on your credit, on your record, you know, the emotional effect of being sued.
Mary Washington Hospital's lawsuits have gotten the attention of Martin McCary, a surgeon at Johns Hopkins in Baltimore.
This is a disgrace. It's a disgrace every place where it happens. Hospitals are supposed to be a refuge for the sick and injured. So to see these aggressive and even predatory collection strategies affect everyday teachers, farmers, even nurses, it's heartbreaking. And it's wrong, and it needs to stop.
McCary first found out about this hospital's lawsuits last fall while working on The Price We Pay, his forthcoming book on the healthcare system. That led to formal research and the study published today in JAMA.
We looked at all Virginia hospitals and found that most have never sued a patient. About 30-some percent have sued a patient, and a small fraction of them, about 10%, sue very aggressively and oftentimes very quickly.
He's now part of a full-fledged advocacy effort to get Mary Washington Hospital to stop suing. He's written to the hospital board and CEO. He's been coming to Fredericksburg every month for hospital docket day, bringing students and other doctors with him. They've even brought in a local attorney.
My real name's Joseph Kirchgessner, but I go by Joey K or Joey Kirchgessner.
So far, he's represented about 15 patients in contesting their Mary Washington Hospital bills. This month, when he came to court, he took Deja Smith on as a new client.
I need to meet with her one-on-one, and we're going to try to either get the payment lowered, removed altogether, which is a little bit less likely.
Just lowering the amount the hospital garnishes each month would help. Right now, Smith says she's only left with about $1,400 a month, and her rent is over $1,000.
If they wasn't garnished my check, I'd be fine. Like, I would have everything that I needed, saving money, everything be paid, food be in the house. I literally have no food in my house because of the garnishing my check. So I'm, like, asking people and borrowing money from people.
And she took on a second job. She says now, if she had a medical issue, she would go to urgent care. She says she stays away from Mary Washington. Selena Simmons-Duffin, NPR News, Fredericksburg, Virginia.
Things have happened. It's amazing when I talk to people and they say, man, I've been seeing folks protest and nothing has happened. When in reality, there are 40 new laws in 24 states. You would not have the number of police departments' body cameras.
Mayor Pete Buttigieg was supposed to be on the campaign trail in South Carolina on Friday. Instead, he was back home in South Bend, Indiana, facing protesters who were angry over his response to the June 16th killing of Eric Logan.
Did you just ask me if Black Lives Matter?
Yes, we want to
hear you say. Of course, Black Lives Matter.
Now fire your car!
Logan, who is black, was shot and killed by a white police officer after being found breaking into parked cars, according to officials. He did not have a gun, but police say he had a knife. The officer who shot Logan, South Bend Sergeant Ryan O'Neill, did not switch on his body camera, and now members of the community are demanding answers about what prompted Logan's death. Oliver Davis is a South Bend Common Councilman serving the 6th District, and he's watched as tensions between the African-American community, the largely white police force, and the mayor's office have escalated over the years. Councilman Davis, thanks for joining us.
Thank you again for having me.
Before we get into the details of how the mayor is handling the situation, can you give us a sense of what the latest is on the investigation into Eric Logan's death?
Currently, everything's at the prosecutor's office, and that's being handled there. That's our understanding. Where we are as a city council is at our council meeting. We will be sending individual letters to our local prosecutor asking for a special investigation into the Eric Logan matter. Because of many of the uprisings that is going on in town, there's a lack of trust.
And talking a little bit more about that lack of trust, and more is emerging now from reporters who are familiar with the region about the relationships between the police and the black community in South Bend. Can you give us a sense, is this a new phenomenon, or have these tensions always existed?
This is my 12th year on the council. And a lot of the tensions that started with this particular situation started back in 2012, right in the middle of a Trayvon Martin rally that was being held here in South Bend. I received a phone call on that Thursday back in 2012 that our police chief, who was an African-American male, who was highly respected, not only in African-American communities here in South Bend, both throughout our whole entire community, had just been fired. And so I made a phone call over to the mayor to confirm that. And he told me, well, I guess the cat's out the bag. And we had over 200 people that showed up in protest of that. And we started to ask for an investigation to this matter. In fact, we said that the South Bend Common Council is going to subpoena the police tapes. We had some officers talk about some racial actions that were going on in the police department on tapes. And they then said that we could not hear them. And so it's been a legal battle for the last 7 years. Mayor Pete Buttigieg sued the council, and we have been held up in court for the last 7 years. As a legislative branch, we believe that we can subpoena according to state rules. And Mayor Pete talks about some of that in his book, The Shortest Way Home. We believe that that really started to build the distrust between him and those of us in the community because of how he handled it. He has a right to choose who he wants to in terms of his officers. But the way he went about debasing, degrading Chief Boykins had a sour taste in many of our mouths.
Mayor Pete held a town hall in South Bend on Sunday. I'd like to play a clip from that town hall and hear your reaction to that.
The effort to recruit more minority officers to the police department and the effort to introduce body cameras have not succeeded. And I accept responsibility for that.
Councilman Davis, can you talk a little bit about Mayor Pete's response there or his comments there? And more broadly, was he able to address the concerns of the Black community in South Bend?
No, he was not, because of we all did a resolution asking for more diversity within the South Bend Police Department back in December of 2004. And that has not happened. In fact, it's continually to decrease. And in a city with the diversity that is found in South Bend, to have basically about less than 5% of the police force African-American is a disgrace. We have close to 30% of this town that's African-American. And to say that, well, we can't find anybody or people are not signing up or they drop in the middle of an interview and they don't complete their interview is something that we must not accept.
There were protests on Friday in South Bend, and a couple of tense moments emerged in those protests between Mayor Pete and Black community members. He was asked specifically if Black Lives Matter. He answered, of course, Black Lives Matter. What was the response to that answer? Was that satisfactory?
There's a lot of words that are being said, but actions speak louder than words. There's a saying that if you don't practice what you preach, is only a speech and it won't reach. And that's the challenge that we have, is his speech reaching various communities. Not only were African-Americans in that crowd, there were many of our white community that was in that crowd screaming also.
There are people who would say that the criticism of Mayor Pete right now is not fair, that he left the campaign trail, has made an effort to respond to the needs of the community, has held a town hall, has embraced, if you will, the language of Black Lives Matter. What's your response to that? Is this a temporary moment for Mayor Pete, and will he be able to recover?
Well, the challenge of running for president as a mayor is not the easiest challenge. You can see that in Mayor de Blasio in New York. And the challenges he's had in gaining traction. And so mayors have a unique challenge that the United States senators or Congress officers do not have to deal with. And even in this whole crisis, nobody's calling on Senator Young or our Senator Brom to deal with this. These are issues that local politicians, local city council, local mayors have to deal with. And this is where the rubber meets the road down here at the local politics. Tip O'Neill said it, all politics is local. And many of the actions that we as local officials have to make, the national officials do, and federal officials don't have to deal with that. Many of them can raise their own families in Washington, D.C., and Virginia, Maryland area, even though they're senators. We have to live within our districts. We go to our barbershops, our churches, our beauty shops, our communities, where as soon as we make a decision, we hear the effects of that on our way home.
Oliver Davis is the South Bend Common Councilman serving the city's 6th District. Councilman Davis, thanks for being with The Takeaway.
Thank you.
Throughout history, finding any level of peace in areas of war or conflict has been difficult. Achieving common ground seems to always be the hardest hurdle to get over. Until that happens, nothing really gets accomplished. But every once in a while, something does happen. A tragedy, usually. Something that hurts so much and cuts so deep that both sides stop for a minute to take stock. Here in L.A., one of the longest-running and deadliest feuds has been between rival gangs, the Bloods and the Crips. But the shooting death of rapper Nipsey Hussle 3 months ago may be the violent tragedy that could one day lead to peace between the two. Cindy Chang, along with Nicole Santa Cruz, dove deep into this for the L.A. Times. Cindy is with us in studio. Welcome.
Thanks, A.
Now, Nipsey Hussle was killed March 31st. The outpouring of grief was seen, heard, and felt all over the city. When did you get a sense that his death could be the start of the Crips and Bloods maybe coming together peacefully?
So, as you know, at Nipsey's clothing store on Slauson and Crenshaw, there was this spontaneous vigil that lasted for, you know, days, and all sorts of people came to pay tribute to him. And we first had an inkling that something was going on with the gangs, because the Friday after his death, there was a call for gang members to gather at the vigil, and, you know, precautions had been taken so that it would be safe. And so people from rival gangs from all across the city came there and were together and took photos together. So that was a sign that something was happening, but it turned out to be much more than just that one day.
Now, Hussle was a member of the Roland 60s Crips, as was his accused killer. How did his death blur the blue and red colors of both gangs into what seemingly became a shared grief?
Well, he had always, in his music and in his actions, tried to create unity. He had performed with members of Blood's gangs. So, you know, not only was everyone really sad about his death, but they wanted to carry forward his legacy, and this was one way to do it.
Yeah. Now, within the Crips and Bloods, there are subsets. For example, Hussle was a member of the Roland 60s Crips. There's also the Roland 40s Crips, and then the Bloods all have their neighborhood-specific chapters. When we hear that they're all sitting down to talk peace, who exactly is meeting with who?
So, first of all, although there's lots of bad blood between Crips and Bloods, there's just as much feuding between Crips sets and between Blood sets. So when you talk about peace, it's not like there can ever be one citywide agreement that everyone signs and all of a sudden there's no shooting. What it really involves is each gang coming to an agreement with its own enemies. And they're, you know, hundreds of gangs. And with this, we're talking primarily about African-American gangs. It doesn't seem like Latino gangs are talking peace at this time in the same way. But what's happening is there are these sort of bigger meetings. You know, it's taking place in Compton, on the west side of South L.A. It's taking place on the east side of South L.A. And that's just a way for gang members to come together and sort of, you know, throw out ideas and get inspired by each other. But the real work comes when they go home, both negotiating with their enemies and with their own people to make sure people are on board with this, because all it takes is one person to act out for everything to collapse.
Yeah. Now, what exactly are they talking about when they meet? What actions do they offer, and how are those actions received?
So, you know, a lot of people sketched out the urgency of the problem. And towards the end of the meeting, someone said, hey, what about if you see a member of a rival gang, instead of flashing a gang sign, just nod? And if the other person nods back, that means they're also on board with the movement. So, you know, there were a few dozen people in that room who were leaders of their gang. So now they have to go back to their gang and tell people about that idea and convince people to do it. And there are all different generations. A lot of the people in that room were probably 40 years old or older. And a lot of the people who are actually doing violence are much younger than that.
So let's get into that part, because of the generational differences. That has a lot to do here. The older OGs, say, compared to the younger members, in terms of their mentality and possible acceptance about a different way to live, how much of a difference is there between the two?
It's, you know, a 50-year-old guy talking to a 20-year-old guy, you know, you might respect him because he has a reputation, but are you going to listen to him and actually do it, or just pay lip service to it? You know, younger gang members, just like younger people everywhere, spend a lot of time on social media. And so that's a huge area of risk where disagreements can erupt. And so that's one thing that happened in Compton after there was an agreement between the Campanella Park Pirus and the Swamp Crips to have a ceasefire. And then somebody started, you know, throwing shade on social media. Campanella Park was notified, you know, hey, you've got somebody causing problems. Oh, so then they had to go and talk to that person. And, you know, one thing they said to him was, real gangsters don't put their business on the internet.
We're talking to Cindy Chang of the LA Times. Now, you mentioned ceasefire. Is what's happening a ceasefire or is it a truce? And what's the difference between the two?
So I was quickly schooled on this by gang members when I used the word truce. And they said, no. A truce means you're actually friends. Mm. And a lot of times they're not ready for that because lives have been lost on both sides. You know, friends, brothers, literally brothers. So a ceasefire just means don't go into their territory and shoot people.
So it's better than nothing, I guess?
Well, at least hopefully there's no killing. And it's easier, I think, for some people who are still really hurting with grief and so used to thinking of the other side as the enemy, it's easier for them to accept.
Now, the LAPD, what have they said about this? And have they been parts of any of these talks?
They're aware of what's going on. Chief Michael Moore actually mentioned the peace talks at a police commission meeting shortly after Nipsey Hussle's death. And they've done a lot of work to work with gang members. There's a city program called GRID where, you know, sort of senior gang members who don't really live that life anymore, you know, work with youth. But this is really a grassroots movement. Law enforcement is not heavily involved.
Is there any evidence that exists that any of this, Cindy, will stem violence and maybe slow down gang killings?
We can't really expect a global peace, a citywide peace, but any little chipping away, you know, say just one gang strikes an agreement with another gang. I mean, maybe that a few lives will be saved. Will it last forever? I mean, probably not. But if it lasts for 1 or 2 years, you know, people say that's very much worth it.
Now, there's going to be some people in these neighborhoods and some people who don't have any kind of gang affiliations that would say maybe a story like this paints gang members, many with criminal records, in an undeservedly positive light. What do you say to that when people read this and say, wait a second, I mean, they shouldn't be doing this to begin with?
Some people might agree with that, but we are where we are at this moment in time. You know, they're not trying to airbrush their past. In fact, a lot of them say that it was being in prison that really got them on board with peace, both because they don't want to go back there, but second, because in prison, Crips and Bloods actually get along because the prisons are more divided along racial lines.
Yeah, they're stuck together in there.
Yeah, and so they come out and they're like, wait a minute, why would I start killing you now when we were friends in prison? Like I said, they're not denying their past, but they're using it to say, I don't want anyone else to end up like that.
Now, this isn't the first time we've heard about gangs wanting to come together in the name of peace. 1992, for example, after the L.A. riots, only for things to eventually go back to the way they've always been. Any chance, Cindy, that this is different, that this maybe could be long-lasting?
I think it's very hard to say how well this is ultimately going to work, but I do think that gang culture has changed. There are a lot more older gang members who now want to be a positive influence, so there are more role models for younger gang members. There are more efforts to get them into jobs in the regular economy. So maybe those things will eventually make a difference as much as the peace talks.
That's Cindy Chang of the LA Times, who wrote about how the death of rapper Nipsey Hussle may be the spark for peace among LA's gangs, the Crips and the Bloods. Cindy, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
Eddie Africa, free. The news came through like a beam in the night. Eddie Africa has been released today. Eddie Africa, MOVE member and survivor of the August 8, 1978 MOVE confrontation in Philadelphia, was free. Eddie Africa, after over 40 years in Pennsylvania state and U.S. federal prisons, was home. The news radiated like heat from a noonday summer sun, and men smiled as if seeing their grandchildren for the first time. 40 years is far more than 40 years if your name is Eddie Africa. That's because MOVE people faced the fury of county and state officials. And that meant a kind of cruelty that most prisoners have never seen nor imagined. He has survived beatings while handcuffed and at least one attempt to castrate him. He has been struck by weapons that have ruptured his abdominal wall. And lest we forget, he has been held in prison for over 40 years, despite evidence of his and other MOVE members' innocence of any crimes in connection with the MOVE confrontation of August 8, 1978. That said, Eddie Africa is beloved among prisoners for his positive spirit and his eccentric sense of humor. Now, Eddie Africa is with his loving family at home. From Imprisoned Nation, this is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
This is Intersection. I'm Matthew Petty. A marker honoring July Perry will be unveiled outside the Orange County Regional History Center this morning. Perry was one of the victims of the Ocoee Massacre, a wave of violence that began on Election Day in 1920. Black residents were driven from their homes, between 6 and 30 were killed, and the town was burned by a white mob. The marker is a reminder of the horror of what happened in Ocoee and the decades of racial terror that gripped the South. So what does this commemoration say about how far this community has come and how much work there is still left to do on the path to racial equality? Well, joining us is Charlie Williams. He is he's with the Peace and Justice Initiative with Orange County. We're also joined by Rachel Allen. She's the director of the Peace and Justice Institute at Valencia College. Thank you for joining us, Rachel. And Will Jefferson, community manager with the Peace and Justice Institute. Thank you all so much for joining us. I do want to start with you, Charlie, just a little bit of background. July Perry, what do we know about July Perry and what are some of the facts that maybe people aren't so clear on?
Well, that's a great question to start us off because this was an incident back in 1920. At the time, Florida probably had a population under a million. July Perry at that time was 52. He was a landowner in Ocoee. It was a big citrus producing region. The town had 795 residents and 244 were black. And at the time, voting was very important. Remember in 1920, this was the year women got the vote. And there was an effort the year before in Florida, starting with January of 1919, a date reflective of Emancipation Day, to register voters. So this was about voting on Election Day. There was an effort to vote, and one of the gentlemen was denied for not paying his poll tax. And so there was a scuffle, and it kind of proceeded from there, and the end result was July Perry was brought into Orange County Jail, incarcerated, then pulled out by a white mob in the middle of the night and lynched.
And that was just the start of things. I mean, essentially that set off this wave of terror, and pretty much the entire black population of Ocoee were driven from their homes, their homes were burnt, and there were decades for after that that there were no black residents of Ocoee, right? I mean, it took a long time, I guess, for some of the wounds to start to heal from that.
Well, it was traumatic, to say the least. The town was burned, buildings were burned, shots were fired, forcing residents to run back into their burning homes. After that long night, the town was quarantined for 3 days, so no one could go back in to retrieve bodies, find out who actually was killed, find out who escaped. We have press accounts to go on, but until we find descendants and do some more oral history, there are a lot of missing pieces.
And on the press, too, it's probably important to note that, you know, there may be questions about just how accurate and reliable some of those accounts were. Remember, in a different case, in the case of the Groveland Four, the Orlando Sentinel recently published basically a mea culpa saying they got it wrong reporting the original, you know, their original reporting of that back in the 1950s. So, I mean, are there some kind of tricky things you have to work through in terms of figuring out what happened just because of who was reporting it at the time?
Well, you know, working with the Equal Justice Initiative on this project, I think they require two accounts that can be to document incidents. In this case, there were some newspaper reports, but And we do have the deeds. We know the plots of land where the residents lived. But it takes some effort to dial that back at history, find descendants, oral histories. Again, we don't know exactly because of those 3 days when the town was quarantined. There's some challenges in putting that story together. So the best we can do is work with what we've got and continue the research.
Will Jefferson, community manager with the Peace and Justice Institute, I want to bring you into this conversation. What does your role involve with the Peace and Justice Institute, and what have you been doing specifically in terms of the outreach around getting this marker installed? Because it is kind of a big deal for Orange County in Central Florida, right?
Yeah, so my role as the community manager for the Peace and Justice Institute is to primarily go out into the community and raise awareness around the incident about racial terror that took place in Central Florida, but to also give some hope to reconciliation. So we do that through a collaborative programs where we are actually out talking about how do you acknowledge these implicit bias, how do you have these difficult conversations in your spheres of influence. And we provide tools that are practical that you can take back with you to your family, to your local communities, just to have these conversations. Pretty much leading up to this work, we were very heavily committed to making sure that government officials were present and that their voices were heard surrounding this situation, to bring awareness to the communities surrounding that may not even know what took place. So we did this through an Okoe Film Forum. So we would bring in a community members into forums, and we were able to just show a film and just have deep dialogue and encourage them to just bring awareness to Central Florida communities.
What kind of response have you been getting? Like, is it completely new news to some people that this part of Central Florida's history existed? Because the very fact that there is a marker going in suggests, you know, only just now, decades and decades after the fact, suggests that maybe this history isn't very well known by a lot of people.
And that is the initial shock factor. A lot of individuals were not made aware of this happening until some of these conversations took place. There were some that knew bits and pieces of that history. So it's been quite interesting. So it's been a mixed representation in each forum. So people have come to just spark their interest, to spark more knowledge, and just to become aware about what particularly happened in Okoe on that night and during that time.
Right. Rachel Allen, put this in context for us. The Peace and Justice Institute at Valencia College, like how important is today the unveiling of this marker?
Well, this is a critical moment. It's something that when this volunteer group of the Truth and Justice Project came together under the leadership of Kristen Congdon, who is a professor emeritus from UCF, she learned about this work that was being done in Montgomery under Brian Stevenson 3+ years ago and said, we have our own work to do, when she learned about the Okoe massacre. And so this essentially is about educating our community, educating people like me, a white woman who grew up here in Central Florida, and of course am aware of race and racism, but really did not understand the role myself, did not understand the role of racial terror in maintaining systems of economic privilege and political privilege, terrorizing whole communities. And so we think this is critical in helping people understand the history. And then, again, what Will said is move toward a process of healing and reconciliation. So when we think about South Africa and the Truth and Reconciliation Project, we cannot do the work of building racial equity until we squarely face the truth of our history. And being from Florida, the Sunshine State, where we welcome tourists from all over the world, you know, we have uniquely been able to kind of hide this history that is really kind of the shadow side of Florida. and at the Peace and Justice Institute with the Truth and Justice Project here locally, we believe that shedding a light and facing the truth is the first most important step to moving toward change.
So, Rachel, it sounds like it's been a bit of a learning curve for yourself as well. How does it make you feel about Florida then? I mean, have you really sort of had some of your assumptions about the state turned on the head?
Absolutely. I mean, when we first learned from the reporting coming out of EJI in Montgomery that Florida had one of the highest cases of lynching per capita during this 50-year period that they were focusing on, I mean, frankly, it came as a shock to me, but it made me really, because I'm, as a native, I mean, the mantra was, oh, I'm from Florida, but we're not really the South. That was sort of what we were taught to say. I believed it, but we're not really the South. We're not like them.
Mm-hmm.
So when this research was uncovered, I realized not only are we like them, these other Southern states where we perceive the racism to be stronger, you know, perhaps we, you know, have even a worse case of this. And for me, really learning what lynching was, it was a public event to terrorize the Black community and keep people out of moving forward in power, in privilege, in prestige. And I just really didn't know that until I got into this project, what the role of racial terror lynchings was in order to maintain, you know, these systems of really, you know, privilege in the white community.
You're listening to Intersection on 90.7 News. We're talking about the commemoration of July Perry. A marker unveiling is happening today outside the Orange County Regional History Center in downtown Orlando. We're talking to Rachel Allen, Director of Peace and Justice Institute at Valencia College, also joined by Will Jefferson, Community Manager with the Peace and Justice Institute, and Charlie Williams, who is a task force member with the Truth and Justice Project of Orange County. So, Will Jefferson, it doesn't sound like this is easy work. For you personally, what's it like? Like, what's the sort of process of trying to bring people up to speed on what actually happened and sort of make sure that they know the facts of, you know, these are some uncomfortable facts that you need to be aware of to understand where we've come from and where we need to go next?
Exactly. And I really take ownership of this work because I come from a family who has experienced this racial terror in the state of Georgia, where I've had family members, a total of 10 of them, go missing by what we know to be the Ku Klux Klan in the middle of the night. Wealthy farmer who had just taken ownership and was really thriving in the agricultural field to literally go missing. And to not be able to humanize these family members, it's almost as if it can freeze, and it does freeze a whole generation of people that become fearful to the advantages of advancement and success, knowing that backlash could be a potential occurrence. So doing this work, I take ownership of it because I come from a family that has experienced this racial terror. So going out into the community and making people aware that, you know, we have to do something to humanize these individuals in their stories and to give their families not only a resting place, but to give them some sense of accountability on the aspect of government and society. We have much work to do. It's never easy. But when we get someone to change a mindset or a perspective, it is all worth all of what comes with this heart work is what we like to call it, mm-hmm. a spiritual journey, just of reconciliation and awakening.
Context of white supremacy, heart work, reconciliation, awakening. This is the compensatory call-in. Words are very important. This is the broadcast where I do request that we not use metaphors, spiritual journey, heart work, awakening. All of those would be metaphors. abundance of metaphors. Even the word reconciliation, not a metaphor, but that is a word that is used frequently without an explicit definition. What do you mean when you say reconciliation? What is that supposed to look like in a system of racism, white supremacy? Words, super important. This is our compensatory call-in. Dial in if you have thoughts, questions, suggestions, how to go about the business of permanently solving the problem. The number to dial, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. Few things before we get to the callers. Wow. My notes runneth over. I will start with the segment on sobriety. That moron, but every compensatory call-in, I think it's every broadcast, it's sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. They talked about folks just taking 30 days of abstinence from alcohol, remaining sober and noticing the impact on how they felt. Not consuming might be worthwhile if any folks are still consuming, haven't made that adjustment to your counter-racist code, but I greatly appreciated that. In fact, I can even give a yoga story directly related to that. The alcohol is promoted so much within the system of white supremacy. I would say drugs and narcotics, period, are promoted so much within the system. Was in a 6:30 a.m. yoga class, just for context. This wasn't in the evening. They do have like 8, 9 o'clock in the evening classes. And that's not what this was. 6 in the morning, yoga class, white female instructor. She plays the very song that I played at the beginning of the segment on alcohol. I sip. She plays it. It plays once. She doesn't have it on repeat. It's going to transition to the next song. She goes over it. Oh, no, no, no. That's the jam. Boop. And plays it again. It plays a second time. She goes back. Let's hear it one more time. 3 times in a row. In a yoga class, no less. I sip. Sobriety would be bad. I thought you'd go to the yoga class to try to detoxify it. Sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy. Next, should have started with this one. Emmy the Great, she's called in for a number of years, made a suggestion for our next book club reading. She is taking the MCAT today after months of strenuous study and preparation. I'm sure she aced her exam, but bravo to her and lots of great things to come for her after all of her hard work. But I'm sure she did a great job on the racist, I think they what they say, culturally biased. That's the phrasing that they use. Standard exams. But I'm sure she did a great job. Next. This is wrapping Pride Month, unless I have been misinformed. They were having a World Pride Day or weekend in New York. They're having all of the big Pride festivals here in Seattle this weekend as well. Big parties and all of that. They shut down the street in Broadway, Capitol Hill. It'll be going on tomorrow as well. Lots of time and energy supporting the gay rights movement, LGBTQ, add on. I think it is always important, Mr. Fuller, where he talks about how that has changed everything, particularly even discussions on racism, white supremacy. They just in the Seattle Times. I shared the article a couple days ago. The NAACP local chapter here in Seattle. They just appointed a black male who identifies as gay as the local president. And they said the chapter released a statement talking about how they want to make sure that this is an important issue. And this is in the history of the organization and just, you know, the same element of civil rights and all of that. They did have some people, they said, who were not accepting of this. Of course, they included some homophobic black people as well. But that was just right here in Seattle. I think they titled it the NAACP, local NAACP shows its pride. That's how they titled the report. But I think Mr. Fuller, very accurate, changing everything. Let's see. Next. Words. The segment where they were talking about all of the meat substitutes. I think Thomas in New York had talked about that a week ago and how much money is being invested in this. And, you know, this is looking like it might be something that becomes really, really popular and profitable for whites and talking about it being picked up in all of these different restaurants and what have you, widespread big fast food chains and such. I do not encourage consuming these products. I have tried one of these before. I was fascinated and had seen it a few times. I certainly, you know, wouldn't discourage anyone if you're curious and you want to try it out, but I would not recommend these products. I was saying that they're probably going to have a plethora of everything that they mentioned. They'll have the fake fish and sausage, and they already have a lot of these products. I've seen some of them, the fake fish and the hot dogs, the same people that have the Beyond Meat burgers. They have sausage links now and some other things I just saw in the store this week. But I would not encourage a lot of that. I think they said they were marketing to meat eaters anyway. I think it would just be something else to give suspected race soldiers a lot of income. I would focus more on whole foods, whole fruits, vegetables, grains, beans, nuts. That is much better. I think Dr. Lathan, she talked about that scale, good, better, best. That would be much better than all of their processed products. We talked about that, I think, last week or 2 weeks ago. All of those processed foods, all of those fake meat products are heavily processed. Hopefully, if folks are trying to be more mindful about their diet, that would mean reducing the amounts of processed foods, consuming more whole fruits, whole vegetables. Next, has anyone heard, seen from Dr. Cornel West, victim of racism, white supremacy? I was just thinking the presidential election is intensifying. They had the debates and all this week. I remember Dr. Cornel West. He was on Democracy Now! And many other news outlets for the duration of President Obama's tenure, often being very critical of President Obama. And President Trump has been in office for nearly a full term, and I just have not seen Dr. West as much. Maybe I have missed the segments that he's on, but it seemed he was inescapable. When the Obamas occupied 1600 Pennsylvania Avenue, you just couldn't miss the latest, you know, comment, criticism that he had of how President Obama was conducting himself, conducting affairs. And I suspect he might have a criticism or two of our current president, but I just don't see him on television as much. Not that I'm surprised about that. I'm just pointing that out as something that I think is significant under the system of white supremacy. They can decide to give a lot of attention to any non-white person if they are going to be in conflict with, talking bad about another non-white person, if they're going to be saying things that will strengthen their system. Whoopee, let's have Cornel West, Dr. Cornel West on every day. Once that is not needed anymore, maybe you don't hear from him for another 5 years. Unless I've just missed him. If folks saw him on television today, then let me know. Next. The segment where they talked about the black residents in Long Island, New York, and how their residences were at the bottom of a hill, an area that was more prone to flooding. That is so consistent. We've heard that so many times, system of white supremacy. They said that, number one, NPR had already done a report that black people specifically, they didn't say black and brown people, they didn't say people of color, they said black people got disproportionately less aid, that areas that had more white people got a higher amount of financial support for repairs after some sort of disaster, flooding, hurricane, tornado, blah, blah, blah. In addition, our signature work here at the context of white supremacy on Hurricane Katrina, we had Gary Riblin on to talk about his book, Katrina. We also read that book in the book club as well. I narrated that one in the book club 2015, in addition to a bevy of other guests and scholars that we've had on the program over the years to talk about the deliberate white terrorism around Hurricane Katrina, signature work. All of that said, they say in the report that these black residents, Long Island, these black residents didn't get any help. They went and tried to address the problem. You're overlooking a poor neighborhood. You're not giving us our resources. You're not treating us fairly. They use all of these words, and it finally comes down to calling out, hey, I suspect racism, white supremacy is being practiced, and bing, then they got action. I thought that was super important. I regretted not doing a rewind right there, but using the most accurate terms. Very important. I would be interested in getting a little bit more data, but that is, you heard it directly in the audio report. Things started to happen once the term racism was invoked as a accusation, suspicion that racism is the reason that we are not getting adequate funding for our houses. And a pattern of this behavior, same thing. Black people in New Orleans could or have written many books about that. We've read some of them on the program. Next. The segment on the hospital bills in Virginia, I immediately thought of the Coon Man. Maybe some of his colleagues from med school are involved in these activities at Mary Washington, sending out collections. This was audio. They didn't have video for that report, but it sounded like the victim may have been a black female. I'm not sure. But again, they didn't have video for the report. But I thought of the Coon Man. Maybe these are some of his colleagues from his Virginia med school alma mater and how they go out and sue these individuals for collections. It would not surprise me at all if a disproportionate number of the individuals being sued are black people, and how they said that the hospital really ends up not making very much money from these collections, although it can be disastrous for the victims of these suits. And it sounds like this might have been an instance where this victim would have qualified for pre-services, but maybe she was not given all of the information. And it sounds like she said she was having some difficulties. We talked about that with dying while black. You go to the hospital, maybe you don't get the best assistance as a black person. Maybe they're deliberately practicing racism. Maybe not. But either way, maybe you end up not getting the best assistance. That's why Dr. Vernilia, Professor Vernilia Randall, that's why she recommended if you can get somebody who is not sick to go with you, that way they can ask more questions on your behalf. They can get if there's paperwork or anything else, because you're not going to be thinking at your best. You're not going to be able to ask the best questions if you are not in proper health. It's always best if you can. And it's just a really difficult situation if you don't have that extra person there to advocate for you, because it just seems frequently black people are not going to get the best assistance. They're not going to tell you everything. They're not going to just give out all the information without you asking questions. Maybe they don't even give you the paperwork that, oh, you can get this. Oh, maybe you're not, you know, thinking correctly or feeling correctly. Let's go ahead and get you in a better condition. And then, oh, yeah, you can get the paperwork so you can get free services. Fill this out. Bang. That way you'll be, you know, good once you get out. Blah, blah, blah. They don't do it. We talked about the Coon Man. Is the Coon Man really going to give me the best services? Is he really going to have the best bedside manner for a black patient? The Coon Man. Continue. That's why I started that one with Medical Apartheid as well, top five, which strongly recommend if you've not read Medical Apartheid and are getting your summer reading list together, that one should be bumped up very high in your reading queue. Harriet A. Washington, Medical Apartheid, in the archives of the book club as well. You can listen. Let's see. This is our compensatory call-in. I do recommend or request that we not use metaphors. If you could speak directly to what it is you would like to say, I would be super appreciated. Lots of metaphors. I already mentioned heart work, spiritual journey. In the segment about Black Long Island residents not getting adequate funding for their houses, they said that Black people were falling through the cracks. Another metaphor. That's a metaphor that I discourage, particularly if we're talking about white supremacy, racism, because so much of what we are discussing is deliberate. It's not accident. Falling implies an accident, that no one was culpable, that was just something unfortunate that happened to you, falling through the cracks. Maybe you even were clumsy. Maybe you're culpable in why you fell. That is not what is happening in the system of racism, white supremacy, and that's certainly not what's happening when you have whites in powerful government positions who decide who's going to get funding and who's not going to get funding, and consistently Black citizens are the ones who do not get funding. That is not falling through the cracks. That is continued evidence of the system of white supremacy. Accurate names. Accurate with words. But anyway, metaphors. We've been exposed to that sort of misconduct for centuries. If we could be direct race soldiers, that's how they practice deception. White supremacy, racism, frequently using those inaccurate analogies and comparisons. Victims of racism, myself included, we are still learning. And sometimes we will substitute an analogy, comparison of some sort, in place of logic, because we're still learning. Maybe we haven't even come to a conclusion yet. Often that just contributes to a lot more confusion. If we could speak directly, be precise, exact about what we would like to articulate, that would be appreciated. If you need more time to come up with your views or how you want to state things, that is always acceptable. I will prompt about the metaphors. Thank you kindly. Oh, let's see, anything? One last thing. I will pause there. I was going to say something about Kamala Harris, Senator Kamala Harris, and all of that happened with her call. Well, I guess I will say that one briefly. They spent so much time talking about that, and former Vice President Joe Biden's connections to these what they call segregationist senators, and how he opposed busing in the 1970s. Could they not have mentioned all of this in 2008 when he was on the ticket with President Obama? Could they not have mentioned all of this in 2012? And they could have even brought it up as, you know, hey, we have concerns about race relations. They did all that talk about Reverend Jeremiah Wright back in 2008. Like, hey, this is an issue that's serious. We don't want any Jeremiah Wrights, and we don't want any segregationists or anybody who's been pals with segregationists. How about you get that Biden off the ticket and give us somebody else? They could have put Hillary Clinton on the ticket. They could have brought this up then. They could have brought this up Mitt Romney. They could have brought this up in 2012. What do you mean you got some progressive? What has President Obama done for the Black citizens? He's been here 4 years. What has he done for you all other than a little lip service about Trayvon Martin? He's got this guy up here who's been friend. They could have said all that then. Why wait until now to bring all of this up? That was one thought I had of many. The main thought that I had with all of that was 4 more years. That's the main thought that I've had about all of this. I have friends that are going to Vegas. If you go, look to see what the betting odds are for the 2020 presidential election. It might be more favorable to wager now. I would definitely encourage putting a few nickels on President Trump to repeat. I thought that back in 2016 when he won. I've seen nothing to change my mind. If they're going to gripe about reparations and accuse one another of being racist, four more years, 4 more years, 4 more years. The number again is 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. They got Pete Buttigieg on both sides. They got him saying Black Lives Matter. That's not going to cut it. And then they'll be able to fuss at him and say that he was mayor of a town where they had this fatal shooting and they don't care about black people either. It's not four more years. Four more years. First few folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions to share, if you have seen Dr. Cornel West lately, that would be a sighting. Please share and let me know. I'll make sure to tune in so that I don't miss him next time if he is actually out and giving his commentary, but I don't see him. If you dialed in and have a hand up, or at least the first few folks who dialed in with a hand up, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi, thank you so much for taking my call. Hope everyone's having the best evening they can have. Great clips. Thank you for the information. I look online and YouTube clips. The last thing I saw with Dr. West was, I guess, a debate with Candace Owens about what Trump has done to Black people. But nothing. Then there's some other things, but nothing mainstream. So I guess, you know, I don't know if they just don't care. They just don't care. I wanted to talk a little bit, I guess, about the word humanize. I hear this word a lot when it comes to Black people, especially Black people who have been a victim of an attack or something at the hands of non-Black people. And I looked it up, but, you know, I should say, it's true. Words, I believe it's true. Words do matter. And I looked it up, and I just got a lot of circular information. Relating to humane, human, the elements of human, the human body. It's like people, it's still one of the other words that people, I don't think, really know what it means, except when it's a white criminal, then they want to, I guess, make them human. But when it's a black victim, it just, then it's like whatever. So something they call humanize them. I think that's another word that when people use, you have to push back and ask what you mean by that, you know, because biologically they have similar features as to all the other races, other classified races of people. So that's the main thing I wanted to bring up. Thank you. Hello, thank you.
Oh, right on. Much obliged. I always commend anyone for looking up terms, definitions, especially that one, because they do use that a lot with, as you said, anytime non-white people have been victims of some sort of major terrorist act, we need to humanize them. What does that mean exactly? explain and... For me, at least, it brings makes me think of Dr. Tommy Curry, the man knot. You could put the woman knot in as well, but you are not a person. You are some sort of thing. Fungibility. That was the word he used so much in the book. Fungibility. You are not a person. You can just be changed to anything. Even using a word like that, humanized, just further suggests the accuracy that under this system, we are not people, not men, not women. Objects, things, non-beings, non-persons, non-humans. Other folks who dialed in with a hand up, if we missed you totally, line should be open. Proceed.
Hello, may I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Ivy.
Salutations, everyone. Hi, Gus. Hope you're having a good weekend. I find it very interesting that there's an allowance of a bombardment of rainbow flags throughout the world and country. But I know that, you know, the red, black, and green flag would never be, you know, boosted like that. Well, boosted might be a metaphor. You know, I just you know, it's really sad that we can't take pride in being non-white black people, but it's okay and highly celebrated for sexual incorrectness to be glorified as it is right now. Not trying to put down anybody that prefers that type of sexuality. I just find it interesting. To the corporal in the Marine Corps, I have some advice for him. I know some people advised him to use the chain of command. I didn't hear anyone so far. I could have missed a broadcast when they said to him to request masks. But that's my advice to him. I reported, I believe, on the first call or something I had to do when I was in the Marines myself. I had to request masks a couple times because of racist acts. And I also did so in writing. So I would also advise him to cite the infraction specifically in terms to the article within the UCMJ that he perceives that they are violating, and try to speak with an ear and eye witness whenever speaking to a senior non-commissioned officer or commissioned officer, and take notes discreetly from now on so he can prevent his notes from being usurped from him, and also to prevent any further batteries, simple batteries, such as what happened to him. I don't know if he's planning on making a career out of it, but now he knows, you know, he's fully aware of what the Marine Corps, how they feel about non-white black people. I had a master sergeant, white male, actually challenged me to a fight. I'm 5'4", and at the time I was less than 130 pounds. I'm not even sure why, but he, you know, invited me to a fight maybe a year before I got out. Tacky, trashy, terroristic. Black Lives Matter is a euphemism, otherwise known as a metaphor. It's no longer impactful or practical for us to say these words anymore, I believe. So if there was a revision to the word God, I think Black Lives Matter as a phrase should go in as something not to be said by us. It's not constructive. Falling through the cracks, to me, resonates black drug use. Black people falling through the cracks, you know, the cocaine use, and it makes our mistreatment more dismissible in regard to some medical apartheid. A friend of mine is a several maladies because of some psychotropic drugs she's been given from young. It has caused bone density loss and some other stuff. And she developed bronchitis. She was given a prescription, an antibiotic that's so powerful that looking at the label with her, it says it has a high probability of causing heart failure, in which she is a heart patient. I think it's a QT. I'm not sure what it stands for. But she has that illness. It also causes tendons to detach from the bone and hallucinations, insanity. And this medicine is also prescribed to children as young as 6 years old. It sounds like it should be something illegal to me. But she pursued due diligence before she took the antibiotic and saw that she shouldn't have been prescribed it, and alerted her PCP, her primary care physician, that the specialist prescribed this medicine to her, even though it's in her record that she's a heart patient. So there's that. And I'll end with today I was in the pet supply looking for some food for my cat, big cat lover. So as I learn things that will prolong any animal's life, especially cats, I try to tell the owner. And perhaps it was uncodified, but there was a middle-aged white male with some popular cat litter that I have found out has agents in it that eventually euthanized. Or not even euthanized, they just killed the cat. And I said, sir, you know, you might want to consider switching to the pine cone cat litter, you know, because the one you have will kill them or make them very sick. And he answered to me, good, because I want to kill them anyway, like just like that. So I don't know if he was practicing racism because I told him about the cat litter. I just know it was like really like it took me aback, because most of the time people, when they learn stuff about, you know, that can help the cats live or their dogs live, they're happy about it. But he was, again, tacky, trashy, terroristic. And I'll mute my line for now. Thank you very much.
Wow. Thank you for sharing. We got workplace racism suggestions as well, requesting masks. I had not heard that one. We had other people who like wrote in suggestions and called on programs other than workplace racism to give out suggestions for the victim, corporal. But I did not hear that one, although we did have one person who wrote in to go to chapel and to tell the chaplain what happened as well in terms of the reporting. But request masks. That is a new one. I'm so sorry that that happened to you in terms of offering a little friendly advice to a fellow pet owner and to be rebuked in such a violent manner, even though it wasn't physical. That's, I mean, if he's saying good, I want to cause another being, another living entity to die. That sounds violent to me, that sort of response. There is that victim of racism who does recommend, as a part of our counter-racist code, to not help white people, not even ketchup, I think is the way it's often said. That would be another illustration of why I make that recommendation, because so predictably, the response, tacky, trashy, terroristic. Yeah, that's why I offer that recommendation. It just... leave it be. I'm sure they can go on Wikipedia or any other outlet and get all the tips that they need. They do not need help from one of their Negros on the plantation. That's generally the position that I take with all of that, that it's just so dangerous having contact with suspected race soldiers. But I'm sorry you had to experience that. That's, man. And I totally
agree. I'll never do it again.
I feel you. I feel you. And I feel in terms of the, I can't even say bizarre, but I mean, I'm not a pet owner, but that seems like the type of thing, if you are into pets or if you have a similar hobby, I go, you know, to the yoga studio, like just mentioning something to someone who has a similar interest. Oh, okay. Wow. Thanks for telling. I mean, that's it. That's all it would have to be. Even if it's, oh, who is this? Why is she telling me this? I didn't ask her for anything. Oh, okay. Thanks. Right on. That's all. And go about me. What is good? I'm trying to kill. Like, wow. Wow. Sister. And again, I just go back to that question. What does it mean to be classified as white? That is such an important question. Just little incidents like that, I think, are a great reminder. What does it mean to be classified as white? Much obliged, Irie. Any other pet lovers out there? If you dialed in with a hand up, you have commentary to share. Line should be open. Proceed.
May I be heard?
Greetings, Red in Nevada.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. Hello, everyone. Just a few things to point out this week or to speak about this week. I was reading the Las Vegas Review Journal, and I know a while back, I can't remember who mentioned it, but someone had mentioned how like the internet access or like Wi-Fi, things of that nature, aren't really made available to Black people, maybe like in certain areas, quote unquote, low income areas. And so when I was reading the paper, it said, I think the article was from either somewhere between the 24th and the 28th, so maybe even today, the article said that there was this program that Nevada is trying to implement to provide computer devices, that's what it said in the article, to low income households. And in the picture, they show this white woman holding up a tablet, and they show Black people around her, basically like almost like in a classroom setting. And it was saying that they want to expand the program. I think they only gave up somewhere between like 100 and 200 computer devices or some type of electronic device. And how they noted it was, they were saying that they wanted to give these devices to these low-income communities so that way they would have the same access as the more affluent and privileged people. Not, of course, not saying, you know, white people, but there was one sentence in the article. Now, just, I'm sorry, I should have already had it up, where they did mention that it was, they did use racist in the article, which I was surprised about. Usually it's something regarding racial or race adjacent things of that nature. One second. It says, the disconnect is racist, discriminatory, and marginalized, and it should not be happening. And this was said by the executive director, Chad Williams. He's the Housing Authority executive director. So it seems like at least they're doing something very, very small. They said that they wanted to expand it to about 2,000 households, but they would need about $600,000. So I thought that that was, I don't know where they're getting this amount from, because I've heard on different occasions people donate so many different things. So $600,000 seems a bit much. And also, this past week I went down to the Las Vegas courthouse just to inquire about some free services. And the main thing that I noticed was that when I was waiting to inquire about the service, I couldn't get on the internet, and it wasn't like I went like down into like a underground room or anything like that. The courthouse here, they have, it looks like it's one big building from the outside, but when you go in, there are like smaller buildings, and or there's at least two buildings, and they're connected by a big glass covered courtyard. And so I thought that it was odd that I could not get on, can use the internet from my own phone inside this courtyard, because it's not like the, you know, the signal wouldn't be able to reach the cell phone towers, but they did offer free Wi-Fi. So I don't know if anyone else has like incurred that at their, you know, different cities or what have you. I thought that that was possibly a way for Nevada to be more intrusive, and to, if someone needed help with their case or to look up something, they wanted to make sure to be able to monitor it. I, of course, did not use their Wi-Fi. I just waited until I got back outside. I'll leave it there for now. Thank you for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, Red in Nevada. That is quite curious, because they're not exactly blocking your access, because if they have, you know, whatever internal Wi-Fi system that they're allowing you to connect to, you can still use your device, but you just can't use your network. Something about that just strikes me as not suspicious, at minimum. I mean, they have, or at least I've seen, where they have suggestions in terms of, I'm not sure. I think, yeah, I might step back outside and get on your network. I'd be curious if anybody else, I don't know if they have that in other government buildings or courthouses in different parts of the country. I don't recall that sort of technology being used here in Seattle, but I'll have to double check. But if any other folks, I'll give out the number again, 605-313-5164, the code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. The report, really quick, from the Seattle Times. The title is Seattle King County NAACP shows its pride after appointing first LGBTQ chair. I'm not going to read the full report, but a section of it reads, the NAACP is finding its way on LGBTQ issues. She explained, we are there on a policy level 150%. As far back as 1993, the NAACP marched for gay rights in Washington, D.C. It formed an LGBTQ task force 10 years ago and endorsed marriage equality In 2012, following then-President Barack Obama's lead, James Bible, Seattle, King County. I think that is so funny. I think I've shared that a few times before. Seattle is named King County after Dr. Martin Luther King. They don't have that many black people in Seattle, but it's in King County. And then anytime they send out stationery for like King County public schools or the public buses or any of the signs that you see around town that say, oh, King County Parks and Recreation, blah, blah, it's got a picture of Dr. King. So you see his face just all over the city. More pictures of Dr. King than you will see black people in Seattle. I think that is just and the biggest racist joke. That's why I say learn a little bit about local, national, global history. It was not always named King County. They changed the name it was somewhere in the 1980s around the time that they finally made Dr. King's holiday a national holiday. It was around then that they changed the name, but it was not formally changed until about 20 years later. It was originally named after a white slave owner. For years, that was King County's name. I forgot his name, but they changed it. And they were upset it's right on time for Pride Month. They said there was opposition to changing it from King County because this white slave owner is rumored to have been gay. So there were a number of white people who said, well, wait a minute. This is an LGBTQ hero. Why are we taking down his monument? I mean, yeah, the Negroes were slaves. And, you know, that was a long time ago, man. You can't keep bringing up, oh, that we got a gay hero. And they went ahead and changed it anyway. But you can look that up. When did Seattle, or when did King County in Washington, when did it get its name? And I think the slave name, it's four different counties that are all together. One of them, I think, was in Oregon and Washington. But this all happened somewhere in the late 19th century. I just went through and researched this. I have been snickering about this off the air for a long time, and it just happens. I read this article, King County, and oh yeah, that's Dr. Martin Luther King Jr. Anyway, back to the James Bible, Seattle King County chapter president at the time, recalled he was also deeply involved in advocating for same-sex marriage. In the circles he was part of, he said, most agreed it was the right thing to do. Nationally, though, the NAACP's position stirred controversy in a community rooted in churches historically opposed to homosexuality. Some NAACP chapter officers resigned, with one reverend telling gays to stop hijacking the civil rights movement. Metaphor. Sentiments have evolved, Sadler said, yet community involvement in LGBTQ issues still lags behind the NAACP's official statements, Sadler said. Very targeted. So I said again, they consistently get that black people are such homophobes. Black people are such homophobes. Got to get that in on a consistent basis, as though there are no other individuals on the planet who are not out in full force with the rainbow flag jumping up and down about gay rights and LGBTQ issues. *61, other folks, if you have comments, questions to share.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Miss TN.
Yes, sir. I had the experience of going down to Montgomery, Alabama, to see the memorial in the museum. Our first stop was the museum, and when you go to the museum down there, you cannot take pictures inside the museum. And it's a lot of reading when you go inside the actual museum. When you first walk in, there's like they look like ghosts, but they're like in cages. They're bars, and they're in these. I guess they're locked up in these cages, waiting to get sold. Go to the auction block for to be sold, and you see those when you first walk in, and then when you walk into the actual further into the museum, there's a lot of reading telling you about, you know, what went on back in the day with racism, white supremacy, and things of that nature. They have like two areas where you could watch small films, And I remember in one of the small little documentaries they had, and I'm paraphrasing, but the guy basically said for Black people to wait for white people to save us is just like waiting for a rattlesnake to commit suicide, and rattlesnakes don't commit suicide. So you're in that area, you're doing a ton of reading in that area, and then when you go to exit out of the museum, there are tons of pictures on the wall of people who made a difference in the fight against racism and white supremacy. And John Brown is one of the pictures that's on the wall. But you have a majority of Black people up there. You have, I think it was Indian guy, a couple of other races, but majority of the pictures on the wall or pictures of Black people. And then when we went to the actual memorial, that was outside. It was pretty hot. When you go to, I guess, the memorial for the first time, my main thing was focusing on the areas in which I was born and raised and the areas in the area where I'm currently living in. So you have like those, memorials hanging from the ceiling. And when you first walk in, there are different counties that, you know, some are hanging pretty high where you can't read them. So when you exit the actual memorial, they're laying flat on the ground. So if you want to take pictures of the people that were hung in those areas, you could take those pictures. But when you're right before you get ready to exit the memorial, they have like up against the walls, they have at the memorial, they actually allowed you to take pictures there, but not at the museum. But when you're exiting out of the, right before you exit out of the memorial, they have on the wall like small little phrases of why some of the people were hung. And it's like a majority of the explanation were white women doing something to white women. And they were like bold and in your face. Most of all of those reasons had something to do with white people. And it was bold. White people did this, white people did that, white people did that. And, you know, it was bold and it was in your face. And then when you exit, now, mind you, like I said, that day I went, it was hot. And so when we exited the memorial, they had like these little plaques on the ground, and we started to read the plaques on the ground, and they were talking about racial biases. I screamed and I was like livid, because when you're inside of the memorial, it's there in your face. White people did this, white people did that. And then to actually write something about racial biases, I was screaming and I was hot. And yes, I was done at that point. I walked away. But all in all, the museum was great until I started reading those plaques upon exiting the memorial that really like set me afire. Well, I don't mean to use metaphors, but yeah, I was very upset when I started reading that upon exiting the memorial down there. All in all, it was great. And I guess you have to go twice, because I say the first time you're going, you're pretty much focusing on your area. And I guess the second time you can pretty much focus on like out of the different states in America, actually how many and the number of lynchings that were done, but I was basically focusing on my areas. Did that. Another thing, like I said, when I left the retreat back in February, I ended up walking out on my job. And since then, I've been working like a few temporary assignments. I'm currently working, my third temporary assignment. But the temporary assignment I worked before then, I was entering into a parking garage. There was a white male. I seen him, you know, I'm in my vehicle. I seen him enter into the parking garage, and he was going down, I say, row number one. And I said, okay, there are three rows of traffic, I mean, three lanes of parking. And so I said, let me go and I'll do the third row because, you know, if something's on the first and second, he's going to get those parking spots. So let me go to the third row. Proceeded to go through the third row. When I entered into the garage, I seen him going, like I said, we were parallel to each other. I seen him going down row one. I enter into the garage and there's somebody pulling out as I entered. And so I'm like, oh, cool. I got that spot. He speeds up down the second row of cars trying to get that parking spot. I had to right away. He would have to hit me to get that parking spot. So I allowed the car to pull out. I backed him to the spot. I noticed he was just sitting there in his car and he wouldn't move. And so I was like, okay, this guy is a nut. So I unzipped the side of my purse where I keep my box cutter and mace, you know, where I could easily access it if I had to, because I knew he wanted to say something to me. So I got out of the car and proceeded to walk back to the building because I went out for lunch, grabbed lunch, came back, going to the cafeteria to eat my lunch. So got out of the car, start walking towards the building. He cuts me off. And he was like, said something to the extent, you seen me sitting there looking, waiting for that parking space. And he was not waiting. Like I said, he sped up that second row of cars to try to get that parking space. And he would have to hit me to get it. So he said what he said. I looked at him, let him say what he said, didn't say a word to him. And I proceeded to decking him to like, okay, you may go. And I didn't want to step out in front of his vehicle because he probably would try to hit me. I didn't want to walk behind him because he probably would try to back up. So I beckoned him to, you know, go, you know, didn't say anything to him. And he pulled off and I walked into the building. So that was, I guess, me practicing my code and just keeping silent. Yeah, that should do it for me right tonight. Thank you for listening.
Well, if I can get in a quick question, Ms. Tien, if you recall, like, the ratio of visitors at the museum in Alabama, like white to non-white, when you were there, was it about even? Was it mostly black people, mostly white people? Do you recall?
Both at the memorial and at the museum, it was majority black people. I'll say maybe I could probably count on one hand the number of white people that were at both locations. But when we were at the memorial, it was this little white girl. She was walking around, just like reading the different stuff, and like, oh my God, I can't believe it. I can't believe it. You know, and people, black people, we're, most of us, you know, everybody's looking at her with the, you know, disgust. But most black people were basically just, I don't know if it was like mourning the loss, but we're quiet and we were just reading and like taking in all of the information.
Wow. Thank you kindly for sharing. I know Big Victim in Alabama also has been to the museum, and he said it was intense to view all of the terrorism. He thought that was what it was a represent, not racial bias, but terrorism, that it was intense to take in and something to mourn, I think, is as you were discussing. If we have any other folks, I know we have other listeners who live in the Alabama area. If you visit the museum, and I would appreciate getting a firsthand report. I'm about 2,000 miles from Alabama, so it might take a little time for me able to take a visit, but I definitely appreciate hearing a codified viewpoint on what you see and who was there and what words are being words are so important in terms of how we discuss this problem. With the parking situation, I'm so sorry that you had to experience that. Again, that is not racial bias. That is not white privilege. That is not a microaggression. That is terrorism, white supremacy, and violence. I think it is black self-respect having the mace, box cutter, any other counter violence weaponry at the ready immediately. And that's why I talk about being mindful of our surroundings, just because it's dangerous. You know, white people are dangerous and these type of things happen all the time. Just that's why I say that on a regular basis. In 5 minutes, you can find yourself in some sort of, you know, potentially life-ending conflict easily over a parking place of a parking space of all things. And to be able to see this escalating. And that's the other thing, too. Like, you don't know these people's state of mind. Like you said, this guy's a nut. We don't know if this guy's on drugs. He could have been in his car shooting up or doing anything with, you know, just... That is the reality. All the different incidents that you see and all of the white opioid abuse that they report on a well, really, it's been for years now they're talking about this. So, I mean, we have no idea what his mental state is, was the number of white gun fanatics. If he's armed, if he's one of those with a concealed carry permit, you just don't know for it to escalate that much over a parking space. Like, I don't know, maybe we have listeners who you get angry and stalk people who beat you to a parking space that, you know, they were closer to than you are. Maybe you all do that. I do not. I think that is tremendous. And I also not saying a word. I think so frequently we want to speak up. I've heard people, sometimes they'll use the metaphor. They'll say things like, I wanted to save face. I didn't want to let them punk me. I've heard things like that where people feel like they are obligated to say something. If you are subject to the system of racism, white supremacy, there is no face to save. You have already been punked. Facts. Now, in terms of counter-racist logic in these situations, what I just said, you don't know if this person just shot up. You don't know if this person has a handgun or assault rifle and is ready to shoot you. You have no idea, or just has on speed dial other race soldiers ready to do whatever. This was not something that you planned. You didn't plan to come out in your car and have some sort of conflict with a random white person. That's not a part of your plan. Like, oh, no, I am out of here. This is not going down. I have no idea. It's too many unknown variables. I'm going to get myself out of this situation and maybe even report him. I feel like that's the sort of thing that might need to be a police call. I don't know if they have security in the building or both, really, because that feels like a really violent confrontation. Did you think about calling enforcement officials or reporting that? Because that seemed, I don't know if he works there. Like, this might be something that it feels as a vendetta. Like, I'm going to remember her and, you know, that type of thing. Did you report him?
No, I didn't report him. Because the way he was dressed and the vehicle he was driving looked like he may have been an executive as part of that business.
Dangerous white man. That's what I would think. If he's real, I mean, he might own the building. Who knows? and that's why I said you want to be really careful in terms of having a confrontation and that sort of thing, because white people are dangerous. I say that all the time. So, but I would definitely. That sort of situation, like him driving up. And like you said, you didn't, maybe he's going to run me over if I walk out in front of the car and just going ahead and beckoning him to leave. I would try and get the license plate and that sort of thing. Just, I think some folks have talked about these sort of situations where it just becomes a vendetta, where he might be there on a regular basis if he works there or is a powerful white person there, what have you, and has to be in that area where he's there. He might see you again. You might see him again. He might, you know, have made note of your vehicle or anything. I just think it's good anytime a situation like that where you are subjected to that type of hostility, try to get as much identifying information as possible, just in case, always in the name of being safe. But outstanding black self-respect, being prepared, non-response, counter-violence weapons at the ready. Outstanding. It is dangerous, man. Over a parking. And that even makes it worse. If this is some really powerful white man in a really expensive vehicle and got his three-piece suit on, he's going out for power lunches and you're out ready to brawl over a parking space. Whew. System of white supremacy. Much obliged, Ms. Tien. We have other folks who are with us. If we have not heard from you at all and you have commentary, please do not hang on until the very end. Go ahead and get a hand up. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943#. Press *61 if you would like to participate.
May I be heard?
Yes, sir.
Yeah, I was listening to, I guess, the piece with, I guess, what Carmelita Harris was talking about earlier with Biden. It was about the busing. From what I, you know, again, about busing, for me, my opinion, I was always against, you know, busing black kids into white schools, either voluntarily or non-voluntarily, you know, sending kids into white schools. To me, it benefited white supremacy. You know, it sent our kids and their money to white schools. And from what I was told about busing from, you know, my relatives that were passed on now, they're a lot older than me. From what I was told about busing, most of the black parents did not want to send their children to these white schools. They wanted the money to improve their own black schools instead of putting their kids in the, you know, out there in the hands of, to be terrorized by white, you know, teachers, you know, calling them niggers, the white staff calling them niggers, the children, you know, calling them niggers and bullying them. And, you know, their black kids in these white schools are disciplined more harshly. They are put in special, labeled dumb and put in special education classes, you know, put on drugs. You know, it made it almost impossible for them to learn under those conditions. And also, too, I remember growing up, I always heard of them wanting to send black kids to, you know, to the white schools, but I never saw the opposite of trying to send white kids into black schools. And the other thing, too, about busing and, you know, and even today, you know, that stuff holds true today. You know, when they send black children to white schools, they don't do any better. You know, they still, it doesn't make them any smarter putting them into a white school. And the last thing I want to bring up, too, is about the food that you were mentioning, about the, I guess, the non-processed meat. The thing about that is, and I always tell people about those so-called non-processed meats, look at the back of the box of sodium content. It's not healthy. It has a lot of sodium, and it doesn't have really a lot of natural vitamins like A, B, C, D, and K that you find in fruits and vegetables. You know, all that stuff is grown in the lab. It's artificial. It makes you sick, and it's designed to make white supremacists rich off of your suffering. That's all I had to say.
Much obliged. Good sir. That is always phenomenal advice. Reading the ingredients. If there's a lot of things that you can't pronounce or would have to go and, you know, what is that? Let me go get my phone out and see what. Not saying it's terrible. Just saying that there's probably better things that you could eat. You're getting better on the scale of food. the more or fewer ingredients, and it's ingredients that you don't have to go and look that up, and it's nothing with 17 syllables and that sort of thing. Let's see. Other folks, if you dialed in, if you have commentary to share, *61. If you have questions, thoughts, suggestions.
May I be heard?
Greetings, caller in Florida. Yes, sir.
Yes, sir. Thank you very much, sir. Greetings to Gus, the host, the listeners and callers. Actually, I was just talking to my sibling, attempted sibling, about that, the nutrition facts, the sticker on the back, and the sodium content, sugar, and the carbs. That is very constructive. Definitely looking at doing that more often whenever I'm buying a product, because I had got some, I think it was cranberry almonds, I think. And I checked the back of the product, and it had low sugar in it. But, you know, I just try to make sure that I'm checking those stickers on the back. But on the, I think, the segment about what it was mentioning, White Castle being one of the first companies, I guess, to try out the, I guess, the Impossible meat product, I believe, or the fake meat product. And either that was the CEO or someone, I was a representative of White Castle, said that, oh, well, we're just trying to just keep up with the times. And the instead of the people, I guess, that were, I guess, nostalgic, they didn't use that word, but the older customers, oh, well, you know, they'll stop eating it in 10 years. I mean, like, is this how you think of your consumers, you know? So I guess they're trying to come up with newer ideas in case people, like they were saying, trying to get meat out of their diets, which is constructive. So I guess that's their reaction or their response to a mass of people doing that, because they may be concerned about people going to these fast food franchises a lot less, and I agree with that. My next observation throughout the week, well, it just happened last week. The county that I'm in, it was on the local news that they're having a $100 million lawsuit for, they use the term discrimination, and a lot of the females, they didn't say what the classification were, but I'm guaranteeing that they're black females. They were being sexually harassed and abused by the head person at the school board, and these are bus drivers. And there was a black attorney that was on the news report saying that they apparently have grounds to put forth a lawsuit against the school board. So that's going to be something I'm going to be looking into keeping up with. And the last one I wanted to comment about is the gang segment about the Bloods and the Crips. And that metaphor was used about they're out for blood, or bad blood. That was the term, bad blood, Bloods and Crips. And the way that they were discussing, you know, the situation with two gangs of primarily black people putting forth harm on each other, killing each other, it just didn't seem like they were seriously interested in it. Saying that, well, hey, you know, if they're all in jail, then they're more prone to get along with each other because they're all locked up. And once they get out of jail, it's like, how can I actually kill you? I think that's what she said. And the way that, just the way that they were discussing it, it didn't seem like they were taking it seriously to try to be direct. And they were asked about the, I think, LAPD, and it looks like they didn't even really have much of an interest in talking about it as well. So I found that very interesting. And that's all I have for now. Thanks for allowing me to share.
Much obliged, caller in Florida. I'm glad that you mentioned that segment. I used the orchestral version of Tupac's Live and Die in L.A. at the beginning of that segment. They did the exact same thing, and I mean the exact same thing, when Tupac Shakur was shot and killed in 1996, where there was a truce calling for peace between the Bloods and the Crips. And these are two organizations that formed in response to white supremacy racism, but that's another broadcast. Anyway, it lasted. And John Patash, I got the book on my shelf right here, The FBI's War Against Tupac Shakur and Black Leaders, where he talks about how that he thinks was a part of the ongoing COINTELPRO campaign to disrupt that peace between the Bloods and the Crips and to indict them and get them blaming one another for the murder. And, oh, well, it just moves on from there. But he had talked about it just reminded me of that immediately, what they're talking about right now with Nipsey Hussle. And it would not surprise me if the same thing happened, some sort of racist interference. Mr. Patash talked about that and many other individuals who study white supremacy racism. That tends to be a pattern. Once non-white people, victims of racism, stop being in conflict, focusing on each other, and begin focusing on constructive things, especially replacing white supremacy with justice. Like, oh no, we got to get this, you know, disrupt that, get them back fighting and squabbling and blaming each other for their problems. But it reminded me of that specifically. And I think what you're mentioning with the regards to the tone and it seeming like that they didn't really take this serious. Whatever. I mean, even that recommendation that maybe if they're in prison together, that maybe they won't kill each other. So that's the solution. Just put them all in jail and then they'll be brothers in confinement and that'll solve the problem. Like, system of racism, white supremacy. That's the same commentary that you had about that segment. And it seems like, how serious do we really take this? Is this really serious? Or are we just, you know, chatting this up? That's what I said about the passing of Nipsey Hussle on the whole. I said that it just seemed like we're not really taking that this serious. That's the same sentiment that I have about the Central Park Five. Like, this is a 5-hour docuseries. How serious are we really about Black lives? Like, how serious are we really about Black people being subjected to terrorism? Even with the Central Park Five case, I've seen continued reports. They had more reports this week where people, you know, were kept talking about that and relating it to other cases. And wow, that is a lot of attention. Like, I have seen a lot of other Black films, documentaries, docuseries. I've not seen Tariq Nasheed's documentary get that level of acclaim and publicity. Like, he's done so many talking about white supremacy, racism. I don't see him get the same type of promotion. That's anytime I see something that's being heavily promoted that deals with racism, white supremacy, I give pause and I give a closer inspection and I really interrogate how it's being processed. I saw a lot of promotion to the passing of Nipsey Hussle, a lot of promotion to the Central Park Five. Pause and reflect on both of those. Other folks who dialed in, if we have missed you totally, you should definitely get your hand up. Number again, 605-313-5164. The code 564-943-pound. Press *61 if you would like to participate. I'll give one more quick anecdote. I was in I have said a lot. Seattle is the best plantation this hemisphere. I've said that frequently. Since it officially has been summer, I don't think it has been warmer than 75 degrees. And I think it's been above 70 degrees, maybe 3 times since it's officially been summer. It has been in the 50s, in fact, quite a few days, even since it's officially been summer. So it has not been warm and beautiful weather in sunny summer Seattle. Not at all. That said, I was out downtown. I try to avoid being in downtown Seattle as best I can. It's very congested, lots of traffic, lots of enforcement officials, lots of whites doing and trafficking in narcotics. I mean, it's a big, you know, big city, downtown big city. I try to avoid going down there, or I try to be very on task. I'm here for one thing only. Let's do that and get out. So I'm downtown on Sunday. I'm focused. Get out. And I look over. Some black female has come up and she's like standing right next to me and she's smoking cigarettes or a cigarette. I don't even see who the person is. I just start gagging and I turn and I'm like, oh, wow. Do you have to I said, do you have to smoke that standing next to me? Put in the form of a question as I'm gagging. Like, oh, my God, what is going on? And she says, I was going to move until you looked at me like that. And I'm still looking, gagging, like, excuse me? And she's like, because you're looking at me like that. I'm like, well, I mean, I can't breathe. I mean, what in the world? Like, and they have lots of laws about smoking cigarettes in Seattle. Like, I don't know where you are, but, oh, man, you have to be, like, 25 feet from the door, and you can't smoke at any bus stops or train stops or anything. Like, I mean, they have lots of laws about smoking in Seattle. She wasn't even supposed to be smoking out here on the side, which I pointed out. I said, well, go call an enforcement official. Man, I thought, if I see an enforcement official, I am going to snitch. Because I was like, I'm gagging. You're not even supposed to be here. I was like, pause. She is a victim of racism. And I thought of the broadcast that we did about how racists deliberately target black people for smoking and how it's much worse for our health. I don't know if she was doing the menthols, how they're especially terrible. I hope to God we do not have any cigarette smokers here, but how they especially are predatory in marketing menthol cigarettes to black people, and they know that that is especially damaging to our health. We had that whole program talking about nicotine and melanin back 2016. Super important broadcast, Dr. Valerie Jackson, if memory is correct. Anyway, I had all of that immediately that I remembered, but I was still gagging. I cannot stand cigarette smokers. It would be totally different if they were them poisoning themselves, I still have a problem with, because, I mean, that is part of racism, white supremacy, and that could be someone to solve this problem. But, wow, the smoking, like, you're not just going to kill you. Like, I got to die, too. Like, I got to have my lungs be contaminated because racist white supremacists have terrorized you with their tobacco campaign. Like, man, I cannot stand smokers, and I try to lecture black people if I end up being around them and they smoke to not smoke. Like, that's one of the few times that I will nag about smoking, just because that ends up having an impact on me and the other people that you are around. I will stop. Please, I hope we do not have any smokers who are cows listeners, victims of white supremacy, racists. They deliberately, you got that whole program. I can go back and get in the archives. They deliberately market those cigarettes to us. But wow, I cannot stand smokers. Woof. Other folks who dialed in that we have missed totally. Proceed.
Hi, Gus. Can I be heard?
Yes, ma'am. Greetings, Draftomania.
Good evening. You had very good clips, and I loved the caller's commentary and also your commentary. Real quick, I just wanted to mention new audio book that I'm listening to. I just began listening to it today. It's called The Confessions of Economic Hitman. I'm not sure if you've ever heard of that, but they have it on audiobook. It's on YouTube. And it's very interesting so far. That might be something that we can consider, reading in the future also. And I am looking at a documentary. I'm not sure if you've heard of it. It's called Aftershock, Beyond the Civil War. I would encourage, you know, the listeners to probably take a look at that documentary. It's very informative, gives you a lot of information on the Civil War reconstruction and actually how the Ku Klux Klan was actually formed and, you know, the victimization of us, you know, during that time. And also, there was another documentary that I was watching on VMO. It was a very, very short documentary. It was about, the name of it is called Black Sheep. And it was about a black man, young man from Nigeria, who lived in London, but his family ended up moving to the, outskirts of London because there was a race crime that happened where a little 10-year-old boy was stabbed and killed by white supremacists. So they ended up moving to an area that was all white, and it was racist there. So, and it was basically about anti-blackness and how he tried to assimilate to become more like them and to be accepted and liked by them. And he ended up trying to, you know, bleach his skin and be accepted by this crowd. And they ended up accepting him. But in order for him to be accepted, he had to basically, you know, become anti-black and treat, you know, other black people bad also. So I thought that was pretty interesting. And I just wanted to mention those things and maybe, you know, if anybody was interested in taking a look at it, they could check it out. And that's all I have. And thanks for the program tonight. Very interesting.
Much obliged. The child, I guess, who was stabbed, that caused them to move out, I guess, to the outskirts of London. Was that, if I don't know if you remember the name, but was it Stephen Lawrence? Was that the name of the victim, or was it a different name? If you don't remember, that's fine.
No, I don't know the name, but I know the name of the documentary is called Black Sheep, and it's like maybe about 10, 15 minutes long. And very short on VMO.
Okay.
Okay.
Yes, ma'am. I'll check it out after the program. If the Black Sheep, VMO, Black Sheep, if it is Stephen Lawrence, his mother was a guest on the program. Her child was stabbed to death in London in 1993. He was 17, not 10. That was why I asked. Might have been a different victim. You know, lots of victims. But he was 17, stabbed to death, and she's been a guest on the program twice. Took 20 years before they convicted anyone of her son's murder, and it still seems likely that they did not convict all of the white terrorists who were involved in this attack. And incidentally, I will say, I think about her almost every time that I hear about a monument or something. We had the sound clip about the Okoye Massacre, 1920 Florida, and they erected the monument down in Florida, Orlando, and the monument in Alabama, racial bias, they say, and many others. I think about Doreen Lawrence. They put a monument to where her son was killed. And this is in the archives, the first time she was a guest on the program back in 2011. They built a monument to where her son was stabbed to death and left to bleed, literally bleed to bleed to death in the gutter in London.
Mm-hmm.
And then they built a center in his honor as well. And she said that they have repeatedly, white racist hooligans, they will come and break the mirrors at the center, and they will come and break glass on the monument where he actually died. They'll come and break glass and pour white paint and smear feces and just anything that you can imagine. That's what they'll come and do to the monuments. That's what I think of erecting these Yeah, I generally think about that every time because she gave such detail about all of that and how they have to go into the budget to clean all of this up. And they have cameras at these areas, cameras all over the place in London, but they still can't manage to prosecute anybody for these crimes.
Yeah, I got the chance to listen to both of those in the archives. And do you still do the international Sundays, or are you going to go back to doing that?
Absolutely. I've just been befuddled with my scheduling with the past 17 months and all. But yes, we are getting back on schedule so we can get Mr. Fox, Andrew, Stacey's normally here for workplace racism, but rest of the folks beyond the U.S. back in. I do think it's very important to maintain global grasp of the problem.
Right. Okay, thank you, guys.
Much obliged, Draptomania. Other folks who dialed in, if you have comments, questions, proceed.
Hello?
Yes, ma'am.
Hi. I know I talked before. Is anybody else speaking? I don't want to talk to anybody.
I didn't hear them at the moment, so yeah, feel free.
Okay, just something you talked about, the King in Washington. I typed in King County, Washington, and you're right, Dr. King's picture came right up. I was like, oh, okay. And then it was named after William Rufus Devontae King. I said, wow, what's his name? And according to Wikipedia, because usually they're okay with this historical information. And this is a sentence from under the subsection relationship with James Buchanan. The argument for King's homosexuality has been put forward by biographer Gene Baker, supported by Shelley Ross, James W. Lowen, and Robert P. Watson. I said, wow, he's everywhere. So I guess this is the King. They didn't really change the name per se because it's still King. It's just a different King. And this is that person. And I looked up a little bit more on James Lowen. And on his page, it's highlighted about his high school that he went to. And I don't know what it was when he went before, but now it's diverse. It said that, I guess in 2007, 2008, that was the last bit of information, that the school didn't make adequate yearly progress because less than 40% were meeting standards. However, that same time period, 92% graduated and the dropout rate fell to 2.6%. And I think, according to the statistics given, the school was what they call, quote unquote, majority minority, where around almost 50% of the students were Black. So it was weird. They don't make adequate progress, yet they're graduating more students. Sounds like racism to me, but I found out about King person because you asked about that. So you said you forgot his name, and then the homosexuality and James Lowen's name came up. So, well, maybe if you get him on the show, you can ask him about that as well.
Wow, I'm so glad you researched that. He's just an expert on everything. That's great. I'm glad we got additional confirmation about King County in Seattle. I just think that's the funniest thing ever, and that just adds to it because they didn't really change it. It went from King County to King County, like laughing all the way. I just think that is I think it is a really great racist joke to have a town with little to no Black people, and Dr. King's face is just flying around everywhere. It's on the trains you see it going by on the subway and on the bus, library, stationery. Dr. King, where are the Negros? I don't even know if he came here. Like somebody asked me that. Did Dr. King come to Seattle at some point to speak? I have never found a record of him coming to Seattle to give a speech or give a visit at any time. If somebody finds that, please let me know. But I have never heard of that. But King County, Seattle. Other folks who dialed in, if we missed anybody, you should speak up. We have about 10 minutes left. Did we miss anybody completely?
Can I be
I heard someone, your volume was a little low. If you could speak up, please.
Oh, that was me. Good evening, guys. How you doing?
Greetings, Thomas in New York.
I caught the clip that you played on the design of, the fork meat, the fake meat. And very good. Pretty much what I've been listening to. I saw Arby's this week in retaliation for all the fake meat. They're coming out with this product called a Marry, which is a meat carrot. It's raw turkey breast into the shape of a carrot with a cooking carrot marinade on top of it to make it a mixture of, you know, a vegetable flavored piece of meat as opposed to a meat flavored piece of vegetable. Also, you have designer foods, which are a novel food. They only exist in the consumer market pretty recently, using biotechnology and bioengineering. They have like designer eggs now. You get designer milk, designer grains. You got probiotics, enriched micro and macronutrient, designer protein. It's a huge market with these so-called designer foods. You even have designer grapes, which would be like the cotton candy grapes and things of that nature. It's some type of crisp. It's the apple. You have those little cutties or cootie apple oranges with no seeds in them, those little things, or designer fruit. So it's a huge market. Sometimes DC called me from Africa, so I think he has some commentary. And I mute myself. Thank you, Gus.
Yes, can I be heard?
Crystal clear. Good to hear from you, sir.
Yes, sir. Yes, sir. It's good to hear from you also. And thank you, Thomas, for helping me out. Wasn't able to call in by calling the line directly. So I had to call Thomas and he helped me. Thank you. I wanted to mention about Louisville. So I was contacted by the family that was affected by the killing, the Kroger's killing, where that white male killed two black people in Louisville, Kentucky. It's labeled as Jefferson Town shooting, like if you were to look it up online. But I think the reason that they labeled it Jefferson Town instead of Louisville, Kentucky, is to be confusing, because anybody outside of Louisville doesn't know that Jefferson Town is a part of Louisville, for the most part. You know, I think it's just to confuse people. Louisville is a metro area, so all these other areas that are in the metro are supposed to be called Louisville when you're talking about it, you know, to outside people, I think. Maybe I'm wrong. But I was contacted by the family before they made a decision on whether this person would be convicted or not, this white person. But I was told by the family, or I was asked by the family, not to speak publicly before the hearing was over. But he was said to be incompetent to stand trial. And the reason why, you know, there's a whole bunch of reason whys, but the reason why really is because he opened his eyelids all the way. So that made him look, quote unquote, crazy. Yeah. So white people, they can kill black people. They can open their eyelids all the way and they can be innocent. And I was also going to say, in Louisville, since I've been gone, there's been a stream of odd killings that don't happen in Louisville that I, you know, I'm not familiar with these types of killings where they're killing little girls. People think that it's black people that are doing the killing, And I think that it's some black people doing the killing, but it's just really odd, this this stream of killings. And I guess when I get back, I'll be able to understand it better. That's all. Thank you.
Thank you for the information, the update on the shooting that happened in Kentucky. I believe this is, or the race soldier, Gregory Bush Sr., I believe was his name, the update there. That was right at the end of 2018, I think. and then the continued updates, both the situation in Kentucky. I forgot the, what was the last thing you were talking about? I was trying to remember up and look at the clock at the same time.
Yes, maybe I was unclear. So there's a stream of shootings that are going on right now where they're saying that, according to the news that I'm reading while I'm here in Ghana, you know, they're saying that some black teenagers are going around stealing cars and killing other black teenagers, and that there's even a list going around, a hit list, to kill black teenagers, and then that the East and the West is trying to have a shoot-off to see who can kill the most people. But this is the first time I've heard anything like this. It seems like white people have some involvement. And then they shut down the pools. The current mayor, he closed all the pools to make sure that the black people didn't have anything to do. But I think that was just an excuse to do the killings and then blame the killings on the poor decision that he made, if that makes sense. That's what my mom thinks, too. So it's just an odd thing.
I'm glad I did ask, because I did not grasp that correctly. I was not focused, apparently. Wow, that all of that is worth investigating, because I had not heard about that. So I guess more folks, if we have other people who live in the Kentucky area or are just interested, I am, share information. If I see any posts or information, I'll share on social media and the like. But and that is always reason to be suspicious, especially if a hit list and such. Like, what? I mean, yeah, I would definitely want a lot of information. That would be something worthy to investigate and investigate with suspicion. And I think every summer we have some sort of report about white supremacy, racism, and black people being denied access to a swimming area or a pool worldwide. That's not even just a U.S. thing. It wouldn't be summertime without black people being denied access to swim water, period. Any other folks have comments? We have about 5 minutes before we conclude.
May I be heard?
Yes, ma'am.
Okay, this is me, Ms. Tian again. I recently attended a doctor's appointment with a family member and concerning high blood pressure, and he was talking to a dietitian, and the dietitian mentioned that he should keep his sodium intake to a minimum of 300 milligrams per day. And she said, pay attention to, when you're reading the labels, the daily value percentages when it comes to sodium. She said anything that is 5% or less, that is something, you know, that you could have, but anything that is 20% or more, that you should try to stay away from. That's it.
Cheetos are going to be on that list to avoid. I know all of that. Cheetos and all of the things that I was at the grocery store. I saw a black female and she grabbed a bag of Cheetos. And I almost said something like, oh, that's going to kill you. I closed my mouth. Like, oh, I don't know her. Minimize conflict. But I almost said something when I saw a grab for the Cheetos. That will definitely kill you. Any other folks have a final comment they need to get in?
Can I be heard?
Yes, sir. Caller in Florida.
I just wanted to make a comment about the mascot. Like, doesn't the mascot wear those black shades? Like, could that be like a marketing, like, to say that he's cool and hip-hop, to try and market that to black people? Like, what do you think about that?
Chester Cheetah, isn't that him? That's his name. He's like leopard or something. I don't know what kind of animal is it. It's a cheetah. Yeah, but yeah, he's got his sunglasses on, and Yeah, he's supposed to be cool. Like, yeah, he's, I remember they've done commercials with him where he just has his glasses on and walks around. Like, absolutely. I could totally see that being like, yeah, we're going to market this. They don't have a white person on eating Cheetos. They have Chester Cheetah, like with his cool black shades. Like, yeah, we definitely want to relate to the black people. Make sure those Cheetos are there. That is, I hadn't even thought about that. Chester Cheetah. Any other comments or yeah, that you can get in 30 seconds or less? We'll assume folks are good. We'll be here. I'm still waiting to decide because folks still made suggestions and I just have not been decisive about the book. But I will announce by Monday. I think that's what I said, by Monday. So people have time to get a hard copy if they so choose. But we'll update about that. Just be mindful other dates and times. I did invite Mr. Lowen on the program, so we'll see if he accepts. This time around, we will have lots to discuss. whether Mr. King was gay in addition to Sundown Towns. Lots and lots to discuss. We can even tie in the Okoye Massacre, 1920. I don't even think I remember that coming up in the book. The holiday is supposed to be coming up, so-called. Be safe. Wow, they got those explosives. And this is another one where I think people excuse a lot of firearm brandishing. So I would be very mindful. They will probably have sobriety points if they're not out this weekend, because I suspect it's probably going to get rolling early. But sobriety checkpoints, this would be a great time to invoke an alcohol fast. And to just be sober, because it's going to be lots and lots of reckless behavior over the next week. If you have to work, fine. If you don't have to work, invest that time in a constructive manner. If it's going outside or being around family, be constructive, be safe. I don't even think I would recommend the fireworks and what have you. I've seen where that can get kind of dangerous too on the system of white supremacy, and it would just come down to time and energy. Under the circumstances, what will be the best expenditure of time and energy? Engaging in battle simulation, going about the problems of replacing white supremacy with justice. I'll say again, just because I don't think it can be repeated enough, sobriety would be best under conditions of white supremacy, especially if you're going to engage in battle simulation. Race soldiers have terrorized a lot of us when we are not thinking clearly to make great decisions. Let's preserve our brain computers so we can solve this problem, crank out new concepts, permanent solutions to the problem. In addition to being sober, let's be buckled up every time we are in a vehicle, passenger, or driver. Let's do all that we can to minimize contact with race soldiers, badge or no. And let's be off the cell phone if you are in a vehicle in the driver's seat. Again, minimize contact in every way possible. Creator, we ask that you help us remain patient with other black people, victims of white supremacy. We ask that you help us remain patient with ourselves. Remind us to demonstrate the highest levels of black self-respect at all times, in all places, each and every time we are in contact with another black person. It has been time. Replace white supremacy with justice immediately. Cows signing out. Thanks all for tuning in.
Nigga, you so brainwashed.
I'm a victim, brother.
Problem. You're a victim.
Man, I'm a victim of 400 years of conditioning.
Shut up.
The man has programmed my conditioning. Mm-hmm. Even my conditioning has been conditioned.